No, it's not. You haven't opened the side up.
No, it's just on through the back. Don't argue with me.
I shall.
So here we are, podcast number 2 of Bowener's Life with my good friend Antonio Lara.
Hello.
AKA the pig bait. Antonio was the main character in my story.
I do actually exist.
Where he's been attacked by... I thought it was 7 times.
It was 7. I think it was 7 in the end. In one trip. No, it was 7 all up.
It was 7 all up, including a couple of the mountain ones.
Yeah.
Which was pretty funny. But today when we're out, because we went out for a hunt today, they still got you a little bit bluffed. Because every time you went to record, you stayed way back and behind a tree, or you stayed on top of the mountain.
I didn't have a bow. Which is pretty funny. I didn't have a bow with me. I just had a camera, so I had no protection. So I thought the tripod was pretty flimsy. I didn't feel too confident in pushing it off. So I stayed back.
And then when we left, you asked for my biggest knife as well.
I did.
Which is pretty funny.
Which I've been caught out with before, and I know I could have protected myself, but at least had a knife on me.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway. No, it's definitely a good idea. Now, I know all your background, but tell the audience your background, particularly around bow hunting and the way that we come to meet, you know, and about our bromance today.
I was born and bred in Wollongong, and I've always grown up fishing with my family. I did have a little old wooden recurve when I was little. I used to try and shoot birds with, but I was pretty crap. But when I got older, I used to fish non-stop, just constantly going to Cape York and things like that. It was just what I wanted to do all the time. And then when I was up in Cape York, a good friend of mine up there, Ty Fenn, he bought this bow, and he just bought it. It was a Martin Jaguar package. Had a couple of little fiber optic pins in. I think everyone in that era got into bow hunting with one of those bows. And I was fascinated. Like, I'm like, man, this is something I've always sort of thought about. And he had this bow. I think we had like 2 Bow Hunting Down Under magazines, and we had an Archery Action magazine. And from those magazines, we sort of figured out how we bow hunt, trying to sharpen broadheads on the boat. So then we sort of would fish, and then we'd go past these floodplains up in Cape York, and mate, I was like the Spanish Point. I would be standing on the bow, stop, there's a pig. And then we'd be out there, and I'd just follow him around. We videoed it, and there was some cracking pigs. Like, he literally shot 2 boars, and they were both 34 points.
Yeah, that's crackers.
Like, that's as good as...
Cape York's like God's country for fishermen and hunters, eh?
Yeah, so, like, here we are catching, like, barramundi, and it's, like, the prime sports fish you'll ever catch. And by the end of that trip, I was like, man, I want to just bow hunt. Mm. So I got home, bought my first bow on eBay. It was like the worst thing ever. And then I started to shoot it. Gandalf just gave us a bit of a rendition in the background. It was pretty cool. And then I had a skiing accident and broke both my thumbs at the same time.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it was a couple of Jap tourists. I did a jump, and as I landed, had to miss them, hit some rocks. Stocks hit the ground, snapped both my thumbs. And I remember my brother-in-law, like, putting the cast on one arm, and then they're going, oh, and he's about to put the cast on this arm, and he's going, oh, don't do that to him. And they're looking at him, and they're like, oh, how's he going to go to the toilet, you know? And I was like, it's actually pretty good thinking then.
You'd have to, like, squeeze the paper between the other fingers or something.
Yeah, what happened then was, I sort of had, it was a long recovery with my thumbs. I couldn't shoot my bow for at least 3 months, but what I did, I just started reading everything, just learning, just absorbed the whole lot. And then I became friends with a guy named Peggle. He's from Wollongong as well. He's one of my very good friends, a very good bow hunter.
Peggle, legend.
And he then sort of took me under his wing, and I would go with him for walks when I couldn't shoot bows and just watch him shoot deer. And then he showed me how to cut up deer, and he sort of showed me the ropes big time. And that was it. It was just addiction in the purest form. It was craziness. So then, you know, it was sort of like a really boom phase in Australia at the time. There was like a guy by the name of Luke Griffin. He was running a forum with Adam. They started it off, and then I started getting involved. Then Luke asked me to come on as a moderator, and, you know, around that time, there was a lot of guys came through, like the Southwell brothers, Pedro Lever, Warney, Casey McCallum, Doug and Tony Stojanowski, you know, guys that are just regular people in the magazines that you see now and in the media now.
Hardcore bowing.
Yeah, and it was like, it was such a beautiful thing, because everybody came on that forum and everyone shared what they knew and what they had. And it was like just inspiring. Heaps of people get into it, and it raised the bar, it raised the standards, it raised the ethics on how we went about what we were doing. Mm. And it was such a good era. So through all that, obviously I became friends with Adam, because Adam was like, you know, that first Bowhunter magazine that we had up in North Queensland, Adam was in it. That was one of his first articles he ever wrote.
And that what was the article?
It was you and Tom McCulloch shooting some pigs.
No, it would have been Matthew Bestwick.
Matthew Bestwick, that's who it was. Sorry, yeah, it was Matthew Bestwick.
Matthew shooting
some pigs. And I was like, man, that's what I want to do, that. And then there was also Pedro Lever. Pedro Lever was like wearing flannelette shirts with the sleeves cut off, buff, like full ripped.
This is a good opportunity, actually, that you brought Pedro up, because he's a guy that I always like talking about. Pedro is one of my good friends, and he was just a legendary bowhunter, you know. He was just all out. He probably wasn't the best shot, he wasn't the fittest guy, but he just went all out. And then the story that I like to tell, because he was a tough bastard, he was tough as hell, is a scrub bull gored him up in North Queensland. And this is a bit of a graphic story, so if there's any kids listening, they probably don't want to keep tuning into this bit. But so Pedro had shot a scrub bull, and it dropped pretty quick, and he was hunting by himself in a very remote area. And then he walked up to the scrub bull, and as he got up there, this scrub bull had only just gone unconscious, you know, had massive big horns. And anyway, it jumped up and it chased him, and it got him against the tree as he was trying to scramble up the tree. And it sort of lifted him up the tree in a sense. And he's like, you know, obviously he dropped his bow at this point, scrambled up the tree, and he was sitting in a tree, and this scrub bull's walking around the bottom of the tree, like just about to die, because he'd actually put a good shot into it, but it just got a mass adrenaline in it once he got up to it. And he felt something warm on his legs, and he looked down, and his whole stomach was hanging out onto his legs, you know. Anyway, he sort of gathered his guts back up and held him in, sort of pushed him back in and held him in, and this scrub bull eventually fell over, and he walked back into camp. And it's a funny story, because my other mate, Manuel Ages, which is an old-time legendary bowhunter as well, Manuel's never had a late morning in camp. Like, he never stays in camp. He's always up in the dark and out in the dark, and he's usually back in the dark as well in the afternoon, the night. And this one morning, he just thought, nah, stuff it. I'm going to take it easy. I'm going to get up and have some bacon and eggs for breakfast and just have a bit of a late start for once. And Manuel, having that late start, was walking out of camp, and just walked out of camp and looked down through a clear section, and he seen Pedro fall over
on
flat.
On the road, it was.
On the road, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Pedro was walking down the
fell
road.
Fell over flat on the road. And then, anyway, Manuel ran down there and grabbed him, and they end up calling the Royal Flying Doctors, and they happened to be in the area, which was lucky. But I think Pedro died twice on the flight, and then twice in hospital. And they kept bringing him back. Like I said, he was a tough bastard. Anyway, he survived that. He had a friggin' ripping scar because of it, but he survived that incident. He ended up dying of a friggin' heart attack that wasn't even related
to
it.
Huh?
It
was from sleep apnea.
Sleep apnea.
2 years later, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he was pretty healthy from it again.
Sleep apnea. Wasn't it thinning of the wall of the heart? He died
from
a heart attack.
Yeah, but I think it was due to his sleep apnea. Because one time, Pedro had another time on a camp in Cape York as well, actually had to get flying doctors again, but that was from his sleep apnea again. Like, he had to get revived and all those sorts of
things.
It was like, it was something that he suffered from. But
he did it tough. It upset me when he died, because he had a tough upbringing as well. But what I said to him one time, I took him into the hospital because he had a few issues, and I took him into the hospital, and he was really concerned. And he's like, concern was, and this is an awesome story, I was thinking about it today when we were hunting, how all this here stems back to Pedro. But I picked him up from hospital, and he's like, oh, I think there's something really wrong with me, you know. And he's like, you know, he was upset thinking he was going to die, you know. And I'm like, I'd be upset too, you know, worrying about leaving Kim and the kids behind, you know. And then his reason why he was upset that he might die is because he's just gotten onto a real good deer spot. He's like,
priorities.
I've just found where there's a good bunch of deer in the mountains, you know, be choking. And then, but anyway, I said to him, you know, trying to be a positive person, and it's true. I'm like, mate, you've lived the life of six other blokes.
He did.
Because the amount of hunting that he did,
yeah,
you know, he'd lived the life of six other blokes, you know. And the funny thing, you know, Rick Crone passing away this month as well, was Rick lived the life of friggin' 50 normal people, mate. You know, and that's makes me rest there easy, and I'm sure it must have made Rick's time a bit easier as well, knowing that he was so loved and, you know, that he lived so many lives. But
made the most of every moment while he was alive.
Exactly, yeah. And Pedro did exactly the same. And he always said all he wanted out of life was the front cover of a Bowening magazine. And he got it, mate. He got on a few. Bowening. Yeah, he did. He's
like the king. But he had a cool crew. Like, you had an awesome crew of those boys. David Whiting, Manuel Aegis, Mark Wills, Pedro Lever, Ben Chambers floated in and out with you boys.
Oh, mate, all and legends of Bowening.
And then the knife maker dude, what's his name?
Wayne Anderson,
another top guy.
Yeah.
They're like the full old school guys that have driven bow hunting in Australia. They've kind of led the way.
Yeah.
So they're all people, like, as I got into it, I was green as, knowing nobody. Me and Peg in Wollongong sort of sitting on our hands. And then we had, like, Mark Wills, Jamie Lynch in Wollongong. They were legendary bow hunters, Shane Coppin, guys that have shot so many deer with a bow.
Mm.
And we had them, you know, I had Peg as a mentor, I had those guys as mentors, being blessed, so... You know, my learning curve was quite steep because mine was cut on Rusa.
Yeah.
You know, and once I got myself a decent bow, like that first bow had to go. It was terrible. So I bought a decent bow. You know, I remember the pins, like, you know, the pins are supposed to line up in a straight line. The pins look like my fingers. One was here, one was out there, and I thought, oh, that one must do curves as it gets out.
Including your broken thumbs.
Yeah. So, you know, it took me 10 months. So I never had any rabbits to hunt. I never had any goats, any foxes. I had Rusa deer. And these deer are probably, you know, one of the most hunted species in Australia. They get the most pressure to ride around in town and
they're
the
most medieval looking species too.
Yeah, they're pretty savage beasts. And I can remember, like, my wife Christina and my father-in-law, like, he wanted meat. He's old school. He wants to make sausages and whatnot. And every time I'd come home, I hadn't shot something, just giving me grief, just giving it to me. What a time waster. What a time. I'm like... And I'm like, man, when I get one of these deer, you're going
to
know
Mick
about it.
Mick just wanted to make some sausages, mate. The wogging him.
Yeah. So then I, like, got my first, and it was a stag. And then, like, it was on the ground, and I'm like, I was so excited. I'm like, standing there, I'm like, what the hell do I do with it now? Like, it was a big-bodied thing, you know. I'm like, fuck. Man, I carried that thing out. What would take normally 10 minutes to walk out? It took me, like, an hour and a half.
A big beast.
And then a week later, shot another one. So it was just like, what? What's going on here? And then it was like, all of a sudden, it was like slaughter time. And it was like, if it was brown, it was going down. That was like our motto, you know. We didn't even care. We'd look with the binoculars. Yep, it's brown. We're going to go hunt it, whether it had antlers or not.
Well, they were nice days too when you didn't have to...
Yeah, there was no pressure.
Like, I'm not hooked up on size, but I just like hunting the big old animal, you know, because it's a lot harder, especially if they eat as well. But it was nice those days where, you know, where just every animal was a good...
hard to get, you know. They're all hard to get. But I think one of the things with antlers, like, obviously they're awesome to look at and whatnot. But what happens is, like, I'm going to target that doe. And if you try and pick that one doe and shoot it, it's going to be just as hard as picking that one stag and shooting it. But you ain't going to recognise that doe every time you go out.
Yeah,
but with stags, they've got certain characteristics. Oh, there's that one there. So every time you're specifically targeting that deer, you've got all the other deer to contend with, but you know that's the one you're trying to get.
Yeah.
When it comes to hunting does, it's like, is that the same one? You know,
you need to tell us about your sausages and stuff.
Yeah, so we're pretty passionate about, you know, using the meat and doing everything with it. We make sausages. We have big sausage days. You know, I think the most meat we ever did one time was like 156 kilos of just clean meat, all boned out.
I remember when we went out west and you had a whole big bag of them, mate. I was just like, put half of the bag in my pack.
I remember me and you shot your biggest boar, that big old skinny one.
Yeah.
And then after you shot it, we found the only dry spot in the middle of the swamp, plonked ourselves down and we're eating gourmet sausages. And I had some gourmet cheese. And
it felt weird because it felt like we shouldn't be eating like kings out in the middle of a swamp like that.
Yeah, we're living it up. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was freaking awesome.
Yeah.
And what about your cured meat? Because, it's freaking delicious. I love it.
So we even make like a prosciutto. But with the back straps, so it's just, you know, putting it in a salt brine a certain amount of time with a few other spices and then hanging it. But that's, you know, you just slice that off, and because there's no fat in it, it's just beautiful cut meat. Mm. Like, it's just on sandwiches with good bread and stuff. Like, you can't beat it. So
yum.
There's so many things you can do with a deer. I never, you know, I cut all the neck meat off. I take the sides off the ribs.
Yeah.
I don't care. It goes in the mince.
Oh, exactly. It's perfect.
It's magic, mate.
Just full of cooler with it. This venison we've been eating the last couple of nights, me and Antonio have had a couple of nights up here now, or a couple of days, up in the mountains here at the cabin. But yeah, we've been cooking up some venison, and it was an old buck as well, and it's been friggin' delicious. Not your gourmet sausage delicious, but pretty good.
You know, I've always, people always saying, you know, don't eat them from the rut, don't eat them from that wall. Most of my rooster stags have been rutting. Every one of my fallow bucks have been rutting.
Yeah.
My red stag was rutting. You know, hang your meat. That's what it comes down to. You hang your meat, you get the blood out of it. That makes a big difference to how tender it is. You know, make sausages with it. Just because it's a ruddy stag, who cares? It's the skin that stinks.
Yeah.
Sometimes the fat underneath, it smells a bit too. But, you know, when you're being cutting it up, just be a bit careful with it. Don't let things touch the meat. Just keep it clean.
Mm.
Mate, you can't go wrong. Like Adam's buck must be probably an 8 or 9 year old buck.
And
it was still rutting when you shot it.
Yeah, and going back and had piss stains on it, like urine stains on it from rutting and everything like that. And just actually a scrawny looking buck, he didn't even look that good, but he didn't look that good in the meat. Antlers wise, he looked friggin' sensational. But
the meat's always still
there. No, look at it. And that's only because I hung it for a little while and then we've cut it, we've seasoned it a little bit and been delicious.
I mean, your old school butchers, you know, they would have sheep out the back hanging, they'd have cattle out the back hanging. They'd have them out there for a minimum of 2 weeks whilst they actually cut it up and serve it to the customer. I think now there's a real, you know, pressure on big fast turnover with meat.
Well, what were you saying? Like Peggle done some tests on some rooster that he was doing.
Yeah, he did some experimenting and, you know, old rooster, young rooster, he didn't care. But what he'd do, he's got a fridge with glass doors and he would just, and it's got like racks in it so the blood can fall out of it. And he did some experiments and he did like, you know, a 5 day test, 10 day test, a 15 day test, 20, 25, and he just went on, and he would then cook it at those different days. And he's found sort of his best day now is something like about 23 days.
Yeah.
And I've gone there and he's cooked it and mate.
Yeah, it's the best.
Well, it's disgraceful that other people don't get to eat it. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, I used to hang on my meat for like 11 or 12 days.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the right temperature, obviously.
Yeah, you definitely have to have like a cool room to do it.
Yeah.
If it's cold winter up here, I think if you got to, you know, keep all the insects off it and whatnot, you could probably do it up here. It's cool enough up here in the winter.
Well, down at Michilago, which is closer to the snowy, so that cooler temperature, we'd hang all of our sheep for like 7 or 8 days. No cool room, just in a fly safe hang room.
Yep.
And mate, it was delicious.
You can't beat it. I think, you know, when you cook meat, when that blood's in it and you see it come out in the fry pan, I think it boils inside of it and toughens it up.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. When you hang it, that blood's coming out of it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the beauties of bow hunting too is they bleed out. So a lot of blood does come out of the system already, but it's still in there. Like if you hang a deer, blood's going to be on
there. Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah.
It's definitely going to be there.
Yeah, friggin' delicious.
But they're definitely not something to waste. I don't know how people raise their noses at it. It's like the best.
Yeah.
Even, you know, I've done wild pigs. They're good. Goats are good.
Oh, it's all
older good. Goats, definitely older goats get a smell in them, older goat meat, but I've made sausages with them, they've been
all right. It's funny, it's all food. Like I cooked up those wood grubs the other day that I was getting out of that wood that I was splitting up, and the amount of messages that I've got were like, oh, disgusting, you must be keen for a feed. No, I just don't want to waste it, and it's still food, it's just the human mind that goes, oh, it's a grub, we can't eat it.
Well, it's a cultural thing too, isn't it? Like,
if we never ate four-legged animals and only ate grubs, and then someone ate a four-legged animal, everyone would be like, oh my gosh, it's disgusting.
Well, I mean, you look at it, a lot of people just won't eat the wild pigs in Australia, but the Germans can't get enough of them. We put them in a chiller. They get sent over there. It's gourmet food for them.
Yeah.
Our goats. Yeah. Our goats are one of the best things now for farmers out in the western regions. Their biggest earner now is goats.
Yeah, they don't.
So we are sending them to
shear them or nothing.
Mainly Islamic countries like into the Arab states. We're sending them into Malaysia and Indonesia and that.
Mm.
And those goats, like, they're rank, man. Like, they ain't being selective.
Yeah.
They're like, mate, this one's 100, this one's 80 kilos, man. I'm going to get more money for it.
Yeah.
They're taking it. They're eating it.
Yeah.
Whereas we'll just turn our nose up. No way am I eating a dirty, stinking goat. Whereas those people, maybe
they're
hung in the shit before they get over there, which makes them good.
Yeah. It's 100% just what they're used to. Like, I'd never eat a horse. Like, we've got beautiful horses on the farm here. But
Italy,
horse meat's...
In Italy,
it's just meat.
It's staple fare.
Yeah.
There's areas of Italy where horse is staple fare.
Please don't go out and shoot horses to eat them, people. But no. I'm just saying, it's just meat. It's just your perception of it all.
Well, Yeah, I mean, it's how these animals are in our society, the respect that they've garnered.
Mm.
Horses are a valuable tool. Dogs are a valuable pet to people.
Yeah.
Cats are a valuable pet to people. But, you know, there are cultures that eat those.
Yeah, that's why people, when they're freaking out, like, oh, they're eating dog. Well, it is a four-legged animal. I wouldn't do it myself because...
Me never.
I wouldn't eat a dingo or a wild dog or a fox or a feral cat. But really, if you're hungry...
It is meat.
And some garlic.
It's a mammal. And it's meat.
Just add garlic.
Add garlic, though.
It's true. All good.
It's worry all about good. The breath tomorrow.
Yeah. It's the rut right now, isn't it, for your bread and butter deer?
Yeah, so the rooster have been rutting. Popped down there one afternoon. It was a bit quiet. I heard a couple of roars. I haven't had a lot of time lately to hunt.
I'm going to make time and come down in the next couple of days.
Yeah, no dramas.
That'd be sweet.
You know that's going to happen, so that's cool. But yeah, it's like they're a pretty unique animal to hunt. Yeah. Pretty savage when they fight. I've watched lots of deer fight and nothing fights like a rooster.
Yeah.
I really believe that they are.
Oh,
chittle go pretty hard, but
yeah.
What I find with chittle is their antlers, they're quite spindly
yeah.
and they snap. But whereas a rooster's got quite heavy yeah. antlers and they don't have the tines. So when you look at a fallow deer and a red deer,
yeah.
Like there's a chance, you know, sometimes they bury a brow tine in and whatnot, but when they go to fight, they hit and they grapple.
Yeah, same like
that
reds,
sort of protects,
you know,
yeah?
Because there's extra points up there that
yeah,
stop
so it's
them.
Hard to get yeah. them face to face or get the tines into the neck and stuff mm. like that. But with a rooster,
it's literally
huge,
daggers,
big dagger
mate.
Tops. You know, yeah. they get like 15 to 20 inch tops.
Yeah.
And you got two outers like that.
Yeah.
Mate, so easy to slip past the outers. Those things, during the rut, there's just no fur left on them.
Yeah.
Big gouges in them. I mean, their food
well,
does
find
come
them dead all the time, right?
Oh, stabbed. Yeah.
I
yeah.
was going like the only fallow deer that I've seen killed in fighting, and a perfect example was hunting with Dave Whiting and Ben Reef, Mark Ballard, and Wayne Anderson that we're talking about earlier, and I found a dead buck, and I just figured, you know, one of the farmers had rifle shot it or something like that, and I got up there and I had a full brown tide and snapped off in its skull dude.
Yeah, one got in so.
Like full, and there was other marks on it, and then the same trip Dave walked right up, there was a big buck and there was a buck on the ground, and the buck on the ground was just about rotting, that's how like it'd been dead for a couple of days, and there was another buck standing over it, and this other buck was skin and bones because it'd been flogging it for 2 or 3 days mate. It
stopped.
And there was just a massive big gouge pad around this dead buck. And here was this buck, the one that had killed it, still bashing it on the ground, and it got that territorial that Dave walked right up to it, and they were yelling at it to piss it off.
Well, that was,
you know,
you and I.
And I'll tell you another thing, that goes to show Dave and that's ethics as well. Like that buck was such a wreck, like skin and bones, bashing that other buck that they wouldn't even shoot it.
Yeah,
you know, and give like everyone's keen and desperate to shoot a big buck, and they wouldn't do it. They'd give it a chance. Yeah. You know.
Well, it's like when. On the other side here, and you and I ran in that time.
Oh, the two bucks
were fighting. They were fighting like crazy.
Yeah, that was freaking awesome.
And then, like, we sort of, Adam said, shoot the metal one, and he'll shoot the brown one, the black fellow. And then, so I got in, I don't know, mate, we drew about 5 times, and then engage and move.
Oh,
they were
thrashing, dude.
I got a good, like, 10-meter shot, just shot through the heart. And then mine turned to run as I shot it. And as it was going down, it's kind of like was doing a little, going to do a front flip basically, yeah. But that other buck was chasing it that hard that it hit it.
Yeah,
and remember, it did a full somersault, man,
right.
Hit the ground, and then it just started flogging
that
it, man.
Going mental.
Yeah, and that thing was dead on the ground, that other buck was just flogging
yeah.
the pants
How
out.
How about a little epic hunts? Like, you get tied up with work, so that's the other thing with Antonio. Antonio is the manager at my business.
Yeah.
Which works out really good, having your best friend actually manage your business for you, and you're sensational at doing it. It
goes both ways.
Yeah, no bastard better poacher, I tell you. Smash them. But, no, so Antonio usually gets tied up at work, and I've employed a lot of bow hunters over the years, so half the crew want to take the
April,
rut off.
April, no one's
April.
Working.
There was one time I had Wilsey.
Shane
I had Wilsey,
Martin.
Shane Martin, myself,
Dave
you,
Whiting.
Dave Whiting. And there might have been one other person there. 6 people, and the rut starts for the fallow deer, and everyone want the whole month off.
Yeah.
Which was insane. But anyway, what happens is you end up getting caught at work.
Yeah.
The rut passes, you know, or the peak of the rut, And then you come here for like 1 or 2 days and we flog our ass off to make it happen. And every time it ends up being epic.
This year, we really flogged our ass off. We sort of, I rocked up with my girls because I've got 2 daughters. And, you know, for me, it's what it is for me. It's like I do 2 weeks away basically and 2 weeks at home. But it's quite flexible if I need to spend a bit of more time here. If I need to get over there quicker.
You've got a good boss. So be it.
I'm on top of the business.
You've got a very good boss. That's like,
and no, because I'm my own boss. Nah. So, you know, my girls, like, they live to come up here. Like, that's their favourite thing to do in the world. In between school terms, all they talk about is we're going to make this game at the farm, we're going to make this game at the farm, and they hang out with Adam's kids and they all get on like a house on fire. And so this year we got up here in that first afternoon and goes, come on, let's go for a quick walk. And I'm like, oh, I guess don't worry, Kim's going to make dinner, it's all good. So I'm like, all right, cool. We only had like 25 minutes of light.
Yeah, 25 minutes.
We sort of just went up, just up the, from the cabin, just walked up the top here, hear one grunting. And, you know, this is like, we were literally walking for probably 3 or 4 minutes at this stage.
Yeah.
And this thing was grunting, and then it was grunting, and then it was grunting. We're like, it's weird, it this thing, gone. You know.
And it sounded like a tiger, right?
It was crazy. It was just, so it's like, that's the noise they make.
So good.
And then we could just see its antlers flicking, and we're like, you know, the beauty with me and Adam is, you know, we both know what we're doing when we bow hunt. We both make the right moves. There's never a question about the person behind you doing something wrong, or, you know, no one's ever going to move at the wrong time and stuff the other guy's hunt up. So it's beautiful because he's got the camera, I've got my bow. We're just walking in. I don't even have to worry about him. He knows what I'm going to do. I know what he's going to do. It's really, really good. So this buck is just, we know, and this thing, we've noticed, it was ballistic. It was like a zombie in a trance.
Yeah.
And it was almost like when you have a gag reflex. I really don't want to throw up.
Mm.
And you get that gag reflex. That was this buck.
Mm.
It was trying to feed. Like, it had been rutting hard. It was late rut. It was probably about the 25th
yeah.
of April at the time. You know, the sort of peak and around.
I remember about, all of his does. Because he wasn't even right with his does. No. His does were all around behind him running around. There was a couple of, like, satellite, what we call the satellite bucks, which are just, you know, little bucks hanging off the big ones. Sort of orbiting around it.
And that's where they run themselves ragged because they're always chasing the little ones off and then trying to get back to their does. And then sometimes it's like you watch a dog round up sheep.
Yeah.
When their doe splits, 100%. Mate, they run and they round them up and like, they hit them and they bring them back. It's pretty awesome to watch. It's one of the coolest things.
When we say they're in a trance, it's like they can't help it. It's like, oh, the doe's running off. I've got to chase her and get it back.
Yeah. But then this buck, we was grunting. He just couldn't stop. So, you know, towards the end of the buck, like they're starving, you know, they've been going so hard. And this thing, it wanted to eat.
Mm.
It used to put its face on the ground and it was like headbutting the ground. And then it'd bring its head up and it'd have to throw its head around and then it'd try to get back down. And it was like,
man, it was absolutely possessed. It was
crazy. So,
and obviously, that's just like the estrus in the air. They can't even help it. Like, they can't help it.
It is. It's their testosterone levels rise from the estrus in the air.
Yeah.
It makes them rut.
Yeah,
it brings out all these things.
It brings out all the instinct in them.
It's just a natural. It's not
like there's a buck that's like, no, I'm not rutting this rut.
No,
it doesn't have the choice. Hey?
They don't. They don't have a choice, and you know they don't make that noise when there's nothing going on.
Mm.
It's just something that's an automatic function, basically, in the rut, and it goes for all deer species.
Yeah,
you don't hear an elk walking down in Whistler.
Yeah,
sitting on the side of the road, still bugling in June when everyone's there taking photos of it. No, they're just cruising. But when those testosterone levels rise, and it is that estrus in the air from the does and the hinds and the cows on heat. That's it. That's what brings them into it.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, it's a sidetrack, but once that estrus drops off and the testosterone levels drop, that's what actually starts the process of the shedding of the antler.
Yeah, I know. It's and so then it fascinating. Takes,
so it's 6 months to grow the antler, and then it's hard for the rut, and it's 6 months for it to fall off.
Mm.
So it's just a process of that, because it's actually solid bone. I mean, you see them fight, it doesn't break.
Mate, it's like a hammer. Yeah. You can bash a nail in with it.
But that bone just breaks down. It's,
you
know, it's a chemical release, and it breaks that bone down, and eventually it falls off, and straight away there's a gel there, and it starts to grow again. So it's just a crazy cycle for deer.
Isn't it amazing that, to start with, there's nothing there, then there's like a soft jelly, but that goes into something that you could bash a nail in to hardwood.
it's crazy. A lot of blood flow, and the gel that's actually a bone graft. It's the fastest,
it is. You can say it, I'll let you say it.
No, it's the fastest growing tissue in the animal kingdom, is a deer's
organism.
So, anyway, so this deer, mate, it's like a bow hunter's dream. It's it's just going ballistic. We don't even have to care, really. Like, sometimes it happens, you know. I could walk these mountains 50 times and not shoot a deer, and sometimes, but that's a part of bow hunting. You got to be out there with a bow in your hand to shoot something, because you're not going to shoot them in your lounge room.
No, that's right. The other thing to say is, like, we've seen that 1,000 times, but to get up and see a buck grunting like that every single time, it's like, this is awesome. This is freaking awesome. Well,
I think because it's something that's a natural reaction in the deer, I think it's a primal reaction in
us. Oh, 100%, mate. 100%. Yeah. It's something that's bred into us, and it can't just disappear like that so quickly.
So it's almost, what's funny is we're talking so much about, it's almost anticlimactic that I shot the deer and just smoked it and it died straight in front of us. That happened. But look at how much that one scenario was brought out in a conversation. Like, and that's not even, you know, that's not the kill.
Yeah.
All that's talking about, everything that we're watching, everything we've learned about and all that, before you even just kill something. You know what? Yeah. If we walked away and didn't kill that deer, we'd still be talking about
how awesome crazy that buck and was. How possessed it was. Yeah,
so it's not, you know.
No, people, so it was. So
bloodthirsty bones. Yeah.
You end up stalking in. I was on the... just a picture camera, taking some photos, got some pretty cool photos of him. And did you shoot him through the top of the heart?
Yeah.
Because he went down in seconds.
Yeah, shot him in the heart. Just it was across the top of the heart.
Yeah, it smacked him. He ran down, he crashed and died. And then remember, we're down there like working out. Because it still was in a basket of a spot to carry out. Like none of them ever die at the top of the hill and you walk them down the hill.
And we didn't have a knife because there's only that tent. Let's go for a quick walk.
That's right, yeah.
Let's go for a quick walk. So we're like, all right, just pick the bow up and go.
Yeah.
So what we did then...
Well, so we carried it out with the stomach in. It wasn't even field dressed. I use a broadhead to duffel button the legs together.
Yep.
Which if someone's going to ask me the question on what do I mean by duffel button the legs together, you'll probably have to go back in my Instagram post. But it's basically cutting a little slot in the tissue between the bone and...
the tendon. The Achilles tendon, basically.
And then you sew the other foot through, which has got a cut on it. And it's like, if you can imagine a duffel button, it goes in, the foot turns, and then... you basically wear the buck like a backpack with the neck and the head over.
It'll be a future podcast.
It'll be a future podcast, just how to do it.
So I'll have to go and shoot another one. So you can carry it for me. It'd be awesome.
So we carried the whole thing out back to the cabin, which is cool.
And I choked because being office, I'm unfit.
You're the office bitch, and then...
I was quite fit before, but right now...
but you did it. I don't care.
Oh, I was choking.
The fact that you're just like, nah, give me a carry, and then you got it on your back and carried it was pretty awesome.
Well, this is what happened, but it was like we knew we could get the vehicle sort of close to it. So it was like where it died, obviously, was crap and it was just like this.
Yeah, so she just
got up there, got to the top of that steep bit, had to sit down, sucked in the big ones. Then I rolled over and started walking again and carrying this thing and just walking off in front of me. I'm just like, man, I'm getting to the point where I'm going to vomit. I'm so unfit. But, you know, it already, you know, and that was a bit of another steep pinch and it started still uphill, wasn't so bad. And now I'm just like, I just can't do it anymore, man. And I'm just going to have to go down. So I fell down. Adam says, well, I'll carry it the rest of the way. Man, it was like literally 25 more meters.
Bullshit. Just,
come on.
Maybe 30.
Yeah, all right. It was about 30. But I was cursing because I was I didn't really. Because my head's down with my hat like this. And I'm just trying. I wasn't even looking at where we're getting to. Yeah. I'm just going, nah, this is too many steps I've done with this buck on my back. Yeah. It can get off.
Well, because it's not field dress and it's got the stomach in, you're carrying 90-something kilos, mate.
Yeah, he would have been 80 to 90.
And then when you carry it up a slope like that, that's hard yakka. So good on you. You know the really, you know my biggest buck this year before I shot the real big one? You know the one that I shot in the rut?
Yeah, just down here. Yeah. No, the one at the... just at the start of the rut, yeah?
Yeah, the one at really the start of the rut. The one that was looked like he was trying to break his antlers on the tree. He was thrashing the tree that hard. Mate, I was...
you carried that thing.
That burnt because that thing was covered in fat still. It was a huge bar.
That was a huge...
that's the biggest one that I've carried. Yeah. I carried a red deer in New Zealand, young 6x6, and that buck that I killed was... well, maybe I'm not as in good condition, but, mate, that buck felt heavier than that red stag that I carried in New Zealand.
It's all part of it.
It friggin' knocks you.
It's definitely part of the experience, and you savour that meat a bit more when you know you've carried it. Like you do, man. You're like, man, I'm going to smash this. I've killed myself for it. I'm going to smash it. It's going to taste twice as good as normal meat.
I think I ate that buck for like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
That trance buck was friggin' awesome. The whole rut this year was awesome. Like, you know, there's been a couple of years where it's just like been hit and miss. You know, and I feel like the numbers have gotten so good for out Australia now that whole estrus in the air has just kicked things off on another level. And this year's rut seemed like the rut that everyone talks about and everyone dreams about, what you see come out of Spain.
Back in 1982.
Oh, exactly, mate.
Yeah.
No, it was. It was ballistic, and your buck was one of those ones that was just going ballistic.
It was crazy. All our friends shot good deer.
Yeah.
You shot
a lot
of good deer.
Kim shot her good buck. I shot a heap of good bucks. Shane Humphrey shot his buck.
Willsy shot his best buck.
Yeah, and Willsy a couple shot, others. Yeah. He shot that real big buck that me and April were stalking in on that time.
Yeah. It was a ripping year for fallow.
You come in, but your buck, yeah.
We had a lot of good rain. We had the most consistent rain we've had. It was like a full solid year of solid rain.
Yeah.
Which then brings out the feed.
Yeah.
Which then brings the bucks into prime condition. The does as well. That affects the does. So those, the better the years are, the more they become prone to become pregnant.
Yeah.
So I dare say that, you know, the good feed, the does know they can produce babies.
It's like,
you know, kangaroos will drop 2 and 3 babies when they have a good season and then don't have any when there's a crap season. So probably that's a part of it too. So the more does that knew, I'm in peak condition, I'm ready to pump out a prime baby, which means in 5 years we're going to have a lot of big bucks running around.
Yeah. Oh, I've done one.
You know, that probably raised the estrus levels as well and just... Yeah, it made everything go off, but can never complain about a rutting buck.
Ah, it's so good.
It's pretty cool.
A bit more back on work, even though, like me and you, don't really like talking about work when we're out hunting. But, because, you know, work's been good for both of us, obviously, and we're not like, we hate work, we're both not that sort of people. But one real good benefit of work, and this is, I sort of touched about this on the last podcast, about if you've got a job to do, and you're not looking for another job, then you might as well love your job, learn to love it and be good at it.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we're both, I don't go away much anymore, but there was a lot of years that I did, and we learnt to love our work, and same with you, you know, because you've been going away for a few years now.
I've got to get on a plane every 2 weeks, you know, and like a lot of people say, how can you do it? I've got to fly between 5 and 6 hours and then get off the plane. Lucky I've got Qantas Club now, which helps. Sit down and eat a carrot stick and then get on another plane for 2 hours.
Carrot stick and a ginger
beer. So I've got an hour and 10 minutes to get to the airport, 6 hours max. Sometimes it's been really long when there's been big headwinds flying from Sydney to Perth. And then from Perth to Karratha is a 2 hour flight, and then it's 40 minutes back to the yard. Never once have I, even though I'd never like it. I'm leaving my family. My kids don't like it. My wife doesn't like it. But it is what it is. If I sit there and I cry about it, and I'm going to sit on that plane and cry every time,
make it a lot
my
worse.
Life will be miserable.
Yeah.
And if it's got to happen, I'm making the most of it.
Yeah.
What the hell else are you going to do?
No, exactly.
If you sit there and be miserable about it, oh, my God, well, you're never going to be happy.
Yeah.
You're just going to be upset all the time and angry at things. Yeah. And it'll just ruin your life. So exactly. I'm like, well, you know,
I want to make sure people don't take it as in, you know, that's the job you've got, working as a cleaner, so you've got to stick with it and be happy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that while you're doing the job, you might as well be happy. It's fine to look for something else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's fine for you to, in a sense, not be happy with that's the job that you're doing. If you want to be a veterinarian, you know, you've got to chase your dream and try and become a veterinarian. But what I'm saying is there's no use whinging about the job you've got.
Make the most of the one that you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to be you can be a very sad person. Yeah. Like, you'll be very sad to be around. You know, you can upset your family, you can upset all your friends, and sometimes you just, you know,
well, I mean, these are the things. Negativity, and negativity brings more negativity.
You can become depressed over these sorts of things. So, you know, I always think, you know, so basically, you know, with Western Australia, like it's, like Adam touched on it, it is the harshest, I would say it's the harshest environment in Australia.
I said, the desert, I'm not shitting you.
Hitting the sea.
Yeah.
But the sea is rich.
Yeah.
It's full of fish.
Yeah.
It's full of beautiful reefs. It's got beautiful islands. They're desert islands. Like, they haven't got palm trees or anything like that.
Yeah.
They look like the desert.
They're full beautiful.
But they've got reef around and beautiful sand, turtle's nest.
Massive big red rocks that just come out of this turquoise water. Just beautiful big rocks that come
turquoise. Yeah, so, I mean, so, you know, when we're over there, what do we do? Yes, work has to get done. And work gets done and gets done well. But you know what? Sunday comes, we're getting out in the boat.
Yeah.
Saturday night comes, we're going overnight in the boat. We're just making the most of it. Or then you've also got, like, you know, it is the most barren place, and then you've got these oases out in the middle of the desert.
Well, how about Carrageenan National Park?
Yeah, Carrageenan National Park, my God, you know.
Look up Carrageenan National Park, particularly like Spa Pool and Python Pool and Fern Pool. where it is. It's just an absolute oasis out in the middle of the desert. Yeah. It's insane. But, you know, that's what I'm saying about that desert. If you look past the colour of it, red, mate, that desert's alive.
Yeah.
It's insane and it's so beautiful.
No, look, I've got good friends over there, you know, like Bundy and the Humphreys and then the guys from work. So, you know, I'll go and visit those people. I'll go to dinner with those people. I'll go do activities with those people. It's not like I'm there, I can't be at home with my family, so I'm going to sit in my room, fold my arms and just say, I can't wait to get home to my family. That's always at the forefront of my mind. I can't wait to get home to my family. But while I'm there, I'm not going to sit there and be depressed.
Yeah.
Because then I'm going to be a shit person when I get home.
Yeah, 100%.
So
yeah.
That's how it is for
and
me.
Just and just shit on your life. You might as well enjoy what's happening.
Yeah. So what I do now, like, you know, with me, with hunting, like before it was like, sometimes every day. You know, I remember marking a calendar and I did 100 days straight where I went to the bush with my bow and had a crack.
That's awesome.
And it was like, it was pretty awesome. You know, and at the time I was right into photography, so it wasn't always about shooting something. So I was taking so many photos. So, you know, the last couple of years, so now, you know, my girls are getting older. So my focus is, my time is around my girls and my wife. So the 2 weeks at home is more based around spending my time with them because I am going to go for 2 weeks. And yes, I do activities over there, which is, you know, we've got some scrubble hunting over there. We can head north towards Broome and whatnot and find some pigs. Oh, there is some camel hunting that we can do.
Even besides that, dude, the fishing is world class. The fishing is off the tap. It's friggin' insane. Every time we go out, it's just ridiculous. You come back with sore arms.
Yeah.
You go mud crabbing. It's such an awesome wild place.
Yeah. So I think one of the things, like Adam and I, we're such good friends because we've both got the same outlook on life. And one of the things that I find that when me and him do something together, it's always something that's the best.
Well, you know why it's probably the best? Because what we're talking about now, we
never complain.
No complaints, no negative.
What else
shit.
Can we do? Let's find the next thing. Yeah. You know, it's almost like kids in the lolly shop.
And so happy for one another. Yeah. And I'm the same with everyone. So I'm not just saying it's because you're my best mate, but so happy for the other person to succeed in whatever.
Yep.
You know, it's like we go out in the boat. If you catch a massive big GT and I don't get anything,
who cares?
Which has never ever happened. I always catch the biggest fish.
That's because I get seasick. And you threaten me that you're going to stab me, so I'll faint. No. No, but it's... But
yeah, no, just always happy for the other person. Like, I'm happy through someone else's happiness, especially yourself or something like that.
I just rushed up here, didn't bring my bow. Today I'm walking around the camera. Man, today it was like 4 pigs got shot, 2 foxes...
And a deer. It was a full.
And it was just like, we weren't even planning on the hunt.
I only had 5 arrows in my quiver.
Yeah.
So there was a few recycles.
There was recycles happening.
I come back with no arrows.
You know, and I'm walking around with a camera and not once on that whole day did I think, oh, it should be me with my bow right
now. No, exactly.
And that's the sort of sad attitude that, you know, it's something you move away from. In my life, I've found that I've always gone away from that type of personality. You know, there'll be a lot of people you think, oh, he's a pretty cool guy, you give him a shot, and then sometimes that trait comes out and just like, you know what, it's not really the trait that I want to be around. I just want to be around, I'm as happy for them as I want them to be as happy for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably too extreme where sometimes I'll just
definitely.
We've had arguments sometimes, you know, we've had full blow-ups where it's like, you shoot it and it's like that time you wanted me to shoot that pig. It wasn't that I was scared of it, which is bullshit. I was shitting myself.
It's that big ball that you're in charge of.
Please have him shoot that pig. No, but I'm just saying, like, it's always been that way with us. You know, we're trolling on the boat, a rod goes off, it's just like, whoever caught the last one, we know the next guy's going to grab it, who cares? But you know what, if I'm like, nah, you're all right, it's never like, get home, say, he grabbed my rod, bloody hell.
Rod,
you know,
grabber.
Oh, he came in and shot that deer right when I was stalking her. Come on, who cares? Just make the most of it. You know, I've always had this philosophy that you can never be jealous of your friends. Yeah. And if you're jealous of your friends, then you shouldn't be friends with them.
Yeah, you shouldn't be in that crew.
You know, that's something
that's... And that would suit your friends too.
Sorry?
And I said that would suit your friends too. If you're that sort of person, then don't be in the crew.
Yeah, never be jealous of them. Never envy what they've got. And always be happy for what they've achieved, you know?
Yeah.
Always be positive about what someone else has done for themselves, because at the end of the day, you might do something good for yourself and you'll get a pat on the back, and it's nice when your friends are appreciating what you've done.
Yeah.
And it might be something you've done for them, you know? Yeah.
Well, you know, I've always been of the theory and thought that because, you know, I'm nothing special and, you know, I get a lot of messages and stuff like that, but whatever I can accumulate, whatever I can achieve, someone else can, or even better than me. You know, and I've always been under that thought that, you know, whatever I've got good, someone's got just as good, but maybe it's not the same thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's just a matter of getting off your ass and doing it. It's almost like, you know, you shoot more deer than people. You shoot more goats than people. You shoot more pigs than people. But, you know, there are people who go out hunting with you, including myself. I'm walking the same mountain. I'm walking the same flat. I'm carrying the same bow. But you know what? You do have a drive there that's a bit... It is. It's unique. It is unique. You know, there's not everybody in the world is shooting game like some of the better guys at a bow hunt. And...
Well, talking about that drive today.
Yeah.
Like the same drive that I put in the bow hunting, I put into the business, you know, for a long time now. It feels like I don't have to now because you're so good at your job that you sort of make me feel inadequate. Like, it's true, you know, and I'm glad that that's like that, because that was always the goal of starting my business, that I could step away from it and go hunting 360 days a year.
Yeah, but then some of my motivation is, you know, I mean, I remember when the business turned around like that was when you went to America, and it was my first shot where I had to take care of everything, because before we used to split it.
Yeah.
There were certain things you always handled, and there were certain things that I handled. There was all this stuff here that I never even looked at or even worried about. And it was, you know, it was a great... We always work together. When you come and work now, we always kick ass. It's like productivity goes up, you know, 30-40% every time you're there with me.
Well, it's like what you said about bowing, where you know that I know every move, and I know that you know every move. And that used to always be the what you wanted out of a trade assistant or your apprentice. You just wanted to get to them to the point where they didn't have to ask you, you know, what do I need next? They just did it. And then...
Well, that's something you touched... Well,
that's how we were in the business, you know.
With everything, really.
But anyway. With everything. But within the business, that's where it got to the point of. And that's why productivity went through the roof, you know.
Yeah. You both have the same drive, the same energy, the same ethics and morals. Yeah. You achieve good
things. Well, that's what I'm saying to all these really good bowhunters, you know, or at someone that's really good at anything, whatever it is, not bowhunting, whatever it is. If you put that same drive and ethics into a business, because if you can do it in one thing, you can do it in the other.
It translates, mate.
Yeah.
It translates. Like, I look at Nick Joyce as an example.
Yeah.
Nick Joyce played AFL for the Adelaide Crows. Like, that's big time, you know.
Yeah.
Nick Joyce, he had to stop playing, injuries and whatnot. Nick Joyce has now gone and poured his energies into running a buffalo hunting business.
And look at his business.
And it he's doing awesome. Brilliantly, you know. Yeah. But he's had that to become a top class AFL player, NRL player, NFL player, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
It's dedication and drive.
Yeah.
That's all that's there.
I didn't even know he played AFL until you told me. Because
he never talks about it, but I just knew from the past, you know. Yeah. When he first came into the bow hunting game, I sort of knew, like, oh, he was an Adelaide Crows player. Mm. And now, you know, his business is going to be one of the best guiding businesses for bow hunters to track down in Australia.
Mate, it looks awesome, because it looks nice and raw and what an adventure should be in the top end.
He's 100%. Also got that drive and energy and work ethic.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes. In anything you do, it's work ethic. Mm. It really is. Like, you can work half what you want to do. So you touched on something the other day. You said, I don't think you got your message across right, because you're saying, I always want to work harder, and people would say work smarter. But I think that I think you've always worked smarter, because you've always done things on the fence line that other people never did. But what you do is you do work smarter and you figure things out better, but never lose how hard you work.
Yeah.
Because the combination of that is deadly. Yeah. Because what some people do, I'm going to work smarter and I'm going to work out how I can have 48 coffee breaks in a day.
Yeah. And no, well, see, that's how good this exactly belly on me can what grow. What I meant was, as well as working smarter, is work just as
never
hard.
Never lose, like, as hard as you work. No,
that's it. If you're going to bust your ass now and you found a smarter way, now bust your ass doing it in the smarter way, and you do 10 times as much.
There's one, and look, it's work-related, but it's always stuck in my head, when you went out there to Roy Hill, and it was like 70-odd Ks in 45, and it even went over 50 degrees Celsius out there. It's out past Marble Bar. It's like the hottest place.
How much is that in Australia? Fahrenheit?
So 50 degrees Fahrenheit would have to be 130.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy hot. And I remember you telling me, like, the heat was coming off your gun. I felt like your skin was coming off your face that day.
And it just goes tingly.
I'll never forget, like, you and Brent were working, and then is we're putting in all the strainers, you'd pull up, one guy would be doing the thing, and then the other guy should be getting the rapid set down, getting the posts on the ground. Once you drilled the holes, stand them up, set them up, go into the next one. And then when you got there, it was like, hey, dude, you've gone and put your tools on the back of the truck on the other side. You've forgotten a tool, and you now have to walk all the way over back around the truck, get those tools, walk all the way back, and do what you needed to do. And then at the end of it, you're picking all your tools up and you're carrying them around the truck. So in one day, he was doing that quite a few times with you in the start of the day. And he was probably doing, you know, that around the back of a truck and back, he's probably doing an extra kilometre in that heat. Mm. And pain in the ass kilometres because, oh, I forgot a tool, you already got the shits with yourself.
Yeah.
And you said, hang on a minute, this is my spot on the truck, this is your spot on the truck. My tools are going to sit right here because you're working off that side, your tools are going to work there. And at the end of the day, I remember Brent said to you, how much did we get done today? I think there was an average of something like about 2 to 4 kilometres. And you've got that day done 12 Ks. And he even said to you, he goes, you know what, I don't even feel like I worked any harder than any of the other days.
Yeah.
So he still worked hard. It wasn't that he wasn't working hard, but he wasn't working smart. So he didn't lose his work ethic. He still busted a gut the whole day.
Yeah.
But from doing it smart, he achieved so much more. And that's the sort of things where you say, look, if you can always work smarter, do it, but never ever forget how hard you should still work.
Yeah.
For everything you, and that's when you'll get the most out of life.
Brent's a really smart guy, just for the record, because he's probably listening, and he is a very smart and intelligent guy, but I see the example that you're saying, but
yeah.
Brent, don't headbutt Antonio with your massive forehead.
Or chat me with your mullet.
Mate, every bloody worker we've got's a legend guy, and we should give him a shout out.
We have got an awesome crew,
because,
man.
Because, mate, those blokes working in that heat, like you just said it, how hot,
it's crazy.
Hot and hellish it is, and these guys do it, and they've just about got a smile on their face 95% of the time, because they're having a good laugh while they're working.
Yeah,
that's what I mean by just making the most of what you've got.
Even from a management perspective, even that's us working smarter, because we spent years now finding the best crew.
Yeah.
And we've
gone
through a lot of different people. And right now, like you ask any of our guys, mate, any day of the week, whoever they're set up with to work that day, they're not going to complain, because they know that person next one's going to put in, and they know they're going to be happy about their day. I've always had this philosophy that every day you got to go to work, if you could spend your time at home with your family, that would be the preferred option.
Yeah.
So you're already going to work, it's already hot and miserable, so don't go to work and make it shitter.
Yeah.
By having a bad attitude. Yeah. I've always had that philosophy. You know, it's already...
Oh, 100%.
You know, everyone would like to stay home and earn
money. I'll tell you what a negative person is in your employment. It's like you've got all your employees, right? And then you've got one negative bloke. It's like all your employees are a clear glass of water, and the one negative person is a drop of sewage. Mate, it wrecks that whole glass.
No one's going to touch it.
It does. One bloke in there, and it'll go through like fucking wildfire.
It does. It really does.
That's the first time I've swore on this whole podcast.
It's pretty good. I've said shit a couple of times. I don't swear very often.
Shitter.
See, I will say...
This is proof that Kim swears more and makes me swear more.
I believe it, even though Kim's going to punch me one now, but I really believe... I know Adam on that last podcast, there's quite a few swear words.
I let it rip.
I know that when Adam's around me and when we're here with the kids, isn't a lot of swearing. Probably was subconscious.
Well, sometimes you'll ring me and I'll have you on speakerphone in the car, and you'll drop the F-bomb and I'll be like, oh, the kids are in the car.
You'll make a point of it. And I'm like, ooh.
But I released this podcast and it was like, FC.
Yeah. Adam's kids are like doing a remix to it, like a full rap. fucking.
Probably Noah. He probably would do that.
Noah's going to break out to
it. They're crazy little kids.
Yeah, well.
Their response to that first podcast was insane, mate. Like, I reckon I'm up to 1,000 messages now. Like, just messages, not comments. 1,000 messages from people on how much they love the podcast. And, like, I listen to my own voice and I'm like, you're such a dick. This is horrible. No one's going to like it. Shit, you talk rubbish the whole time. Mate, everyone loved it.
You know, that's the beauty of it. Look, one thing,
thank you.
Obviously, Adam and I, you know, we're such good friends, and you know, I'll always be defensive of him and whatnot. But there's one thing, even before I really started hanging out with Adam, was that you could see in his writing, in the magazines, and it's more, a passion and a drive to you share the experience.
I'm just going to close this door because it's getting a bit chilly.
So it's more the passion and the drive for the experience. And I've always thought that too. Like, you know, I ended up getting right into the media side of bow hunting and whatnot and promoting it. But for me, and I know Adam's got it, is like, when I started bow hunting, I'm like, why doesn't everybody have a bow in their hand and hunting something? It's like, how can you not want to do this thing? This is like the most awesome thing in the world, you know? So my sort of drive came from that, but that was one of the things that I related with Adam, is like, when he writes, Adam ain't writing about, I shot the biggest buck and no one can shoot a buck big like me because I'm the best hunter. Never ever have you seen his writings come across like that, his presentation come across like that.
I've only ever wanted to promote bow hunting and the animals and for other people to get out there, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's been this whole motivation. Like, how this is so good. This is so, so good that I want everyone to know that it's out there.
They have to do it, man.
They have to do it.
Life cannot be lived without a bow in the hand. Well, they don't have to do
it because it's not for everyone. But
I know it's
not. You know what I'm saying.
But in my head, I feel like everyone should do it. So I'll just promote to everybody I meet and say something about it to everybody I meet in the off chance that they say, yeah. Look, I believe that too. I believe that we've probably got more Neanderthal throwback in us. Which gives us a, you know, it's probably something that's in people, you know, things get bred in and out of people and whatnot. Probably hunters have got a higher drive, that hunting urge in them. It's probably a genetic thing and a natural thing. And there are people who seriously don't want to hunt. And, you know, even you go back in medieval times, in tribes they had their hunters, they had their gatherers who were really good. Oh, I want to be a gardener, I want to pick fruit. And then you had your people who made art.
And that's fine.
So it's always been a part of society.
That's
so
like, I don't have anything against vegetarians or vegans. Only if they want to have a shot at hunting, meat eating. Because I'm not having a shot at them saying, you can't just eat vegetables. Vegetables have shit feelings, or, you know, that's not what God had planned for us, that's not how the world turns, or whatever it might be.
Look on the African savannah. Yeah. There's five lions and there's 5,000 wildebeest.
Yeah.
Wildebeest were put on the earth to be eaten by things that eat meat.
Yeah.
Every animal that's a prey animal, basically look at how they survive. They survive through the power of breeding.
Yeah.
Predators survive by stealth and smart. And generally the predators are much, much smaller in number. And the herbivores and whatnot, which are there to be eaten, are in huge numbers. So they'll just propagate themselves and continue future generations because...
Are you saying vegetarians should have more kids?
True. No. I wouldn't want to eat one. No, but all I'm saying is, like, you know, the human body, so, you know, when you go back and you look at Cro-Magnon, man, and go for all the early species of humanoids, you know, they had a very massive stomach tract, very small brains, and very small lung capacity. And it wasn't until man developed fire and then could start to eat more meat that basically then meat is like a very, very high, the body can turn it into energy very quickly. Like, it's much, you get much more nutrients out of meat. That's energy that you can then can do things with than you do from eating greens, basically. So then as man started to eat meat, brain started to get bigger. That because it digests so much quicker into energy, the digestive tract didn't have to. Look at a cow. Cow's got like four stomachs, mate. A cow's a big animal, has to eat a lot of grass all day just to be able to walk. But where's, you know, cows ain't that smart.
Yeah.
So as humans started to get bigger brains, their digestive tract got smaller, then their lung capacity got bigger. And then we became more better hunters and whatnot as well, because we had more endurance and all those sorts of things. So man became who we are simply because we ate meat.
I know.
Never ignore the fact that we've always eaten greens, and you do have to eat greens. No two ways about it. Yeah. You can have a balanced diet.
Kim keeps telling me I should eat greens.
But meat is an essential ingredient that made man as they are today who they are.
Yeah.
We would not be able to power our brains on the diets at those back then. Like now you've got all these high supplements and soys and all these sorts of things that are put into
we didn't have
the green diet. And you can do all those sorts of things. And like I said, I don't even care. If you want to do it, do it. But at the same token, I honestly believe a lot of it is, it's cultural, you know. We won't eat horses. We won't eat dogs.
Yeah.
I won't eat greens. It's a cultural thing. It's a big trend at the moment. And what you'll find is as cities get bigger and that urban life has become the central life force basically of the world. Well, people aren't getting out into the bush or doing all those sorts of things.
They're so shut off. Because like my normal everyday shit that I don't even think about, there's people out there being like, wow, that's crazy. And I'm just like, no, it's not. It's just normal. It's everyday life. And all those people that say that are like locked in the city. Like, I feel sorry for them. Like, I'm not hating on anyone right here. I'm just telling you how it is. But I feel sorry for them that, like, that's life. That's their life.
It is life.
Locked in that.
It is their life.
It's like locked in that cage and it's shielded by.
Oh, I saw a video the other day. A guy's got a fish, been fishing. And then his family's going, those fish have a family. It's been scientifically proven. I'm like, man, go and ask those fish about how they've been eaten alive out in the ocean, been ripped in half. Go and talk to the moose that's got five wolves hanging off its ass.
No, exactly.
Still being eaten while still walking along.
How about that, like, fish's family? One of that fish's family dies, the other fish eat it.
Yeah, or...
No fucking family going to do that.
That fish from that family will eat it alive. How many times have you seen a fish tank?
No.
The fish has babies in the fish tank. Next thing you know, where's all the babies going? Oh, the fish ate it.
No, exactly.
Like, it's just...
What about bears, mate? How the boars, the mature boars come out and start eating the cubs.
Because how
about the lions? Remember when the whole Cecil thing came out? I put this meme out there and it was like what Cecil used to get up to in his spare time. And it's like this lion ripping, like chasing around little cubs, the cutest things you've ever seen. Freaking ripping their heads off, dude, and moving on to the next one and doing the next one.
But this, like, is where you get back to, like, the urban.
Mm.
So that was so pushed so hard in that urban environment. And, mate, you're talking the majority of people. Like, there's 4 or 5 million people in Sydney now. That's, you know, like a quarter of Australia's population pretty much, or a fifth. But the greater Sydney area is, like, you know, it's probably, you're talking a third of the Australian population.
Yeah.
Not many people know anything outside that urban environment. Mm. All they're seeing on the media was the story that was spun about Cecil the Lion by people who have an agenda. There's no two ways about it. That was pushed by an agenda. The media's...
finding the hearts the media's of people just, that aren't in the know.
But, you know, there's no follow-up story later about, well, this is the reality now. Like, in Zimbabwe now. Like, in that area was a hunting conservation area. When they first took that area over, there were only 70 lions left.
Mm.
There were 2,200 or something lions in that area. Yeah. Once hunting conservation came into that area, because real dollars went into the conservation. On the orders of the government, once they shut down that hunting conservation area, they had to go in and cull all their lions.
That's what I mean.
Why doesn't that get on the media
now? People thought that they stopped the lion killing.
No, they did not.
You know what they did? Went in there and slaughtered them and culled them out. No benefit to the farmers, the property owners, the managers. No jobs involved in doing that except for the bloke going around with a high-power rifle and blasting them.
Yeah, so in Namibia, like, this is the agenda. Like, I don't give a shit, it's an agenda. But Namibia had leopard hunts. CITES then brought out, you're not allowed to export a leopard pelt. Well, farmers used to get paid, you know, anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 US for someone to come and hunt a leopard.
Mm.
A leopard that's going to get shot if it's going to be eating his cattle, but a leopard that will be left alive because, oh, I can afford to lose a couple of cattle because I'm going to get paid for this leopard to get shot. Mind you, that means that the leopards are actually expanding, growing, growing. Now, they've stopped the export of a leopard skin. Mate, them farmers are just like, you see a leopard, you kill that thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's just the open slaver. Yeah. Get rid
of them. There's no value in
it. No value, mate.
You know, Ben O'Brien did the podcast with Joe Rogan a couple of weeks back, and Ben was talking about our trip over to New Zealand and how the animals don't have a value, and he's dead right, but they don't have a value to most of the farmers. It's the same here. Like, our neighbours, every one of our neighbours that lets us hunt,
shoot the deer,
does not value the deer at all. Us as hunters value the deer.
Yeah.
But it's because of that, but... you know, if in the lion case, if those lions are worth 20,000 or 30,000,
they were $50,000 to $75,000 US. That's how much people.
Then you're gonna put up with it, attacking a few cattle every now.
Well, then you're just gonna take your cattle out of the area and just concentrate on having hunters
there
who are given big tips, who are then given stuff into those local communities that have got nothing.
Yeah,
and now they're going back to having nothing.
Yeah. Did you hear me talking about the Tassie devil? You know,
how
find that disease and they don't allow
They have a fungus that grows on them and it mutates their face.
So they really need funds. But what I was saying is a perfect way to raise funds is allow bow owners to go in there under a tag system, whatever, $500 for a tag, I don't care. And the majority of the fee for that tag goes into the Tassie Devil Fund.
Like, oh, to shoot hard. The deer.
Yeah, because you're
shooting. Before you're going to say shoot the Tassie Devils, what are you going to do? You've got to do trophy class tumour on its face before you shot it. No, it's true.
They're like, savage as hell.
So with fallow deer, so with bow hunting in Tasmania, because you did talk about it. So basically, you were allowed to bow hunt in Tasmania, and it was many years ago. So through everything that's happening bow hunting with me, I've ended up meeting all, you know, all the people who've led the way in archery in Australia over the years. So I've heard a lot of information, and you know, it's been good. It's like a wealth of knowledge that I'm always going to hang on to, and hopefully, you know, I've been passing it on, and I will always pass it on. But you know, there was a trip down to Tasmania, and they were shooting kangaroos, because back in the day you used to be able to shoot kangaroos and wallabies with a bow in Australia. You're not allowed to shoot any native animal at all in Australia.
I got to tell a lot of people that, because they always ask me, can you hunt kangaroos?
Yeah, everyone's
excited. But you can't hunt any of our natives at all.
Not a single native. So a few of these, because a kangaroo's got a very small kill spot, so to target them with a bow, it's not really...
It sounds silly, but they're not a bow-friendly animal anyway. No. Just looking at them, you're just like, no.
But their makeup isn't, because they've got a small chest cavity, they've got small lungs, they've got a relatively small heart. You don't head shoot with a bow, you don't neck shoot with a bow, you shoot heart and lungs.
Yeah.
So because they've got such a small target area and they're forward like this, they could be sideways, they jump, they do all those sorts of things. They really are not a very good animal to hunt with a bow regardless.
National icon.
So what happened was, anyway, a few animals were running around with some arrows sticking out of them, and then that created an uproar. And Tasmania is a very, very... It's the most green state in Australia. It's like everyone's anti-logging, anti-this, even though it's their main industry. So they banned bow hunting.
Anti-logging is insane.
Yeah.
Like...
Trees grow.
Trees grow.
It's a renewable resource.
Mountains that they move to get iron ore to make metal do not regrow.
No.
And every tree on top of it is removed as well anyway. So all these people that always push for, no timber and everything like that, are you insane?
Having said that, I will say that these coal mines around here in the Hunter Valley... where they do their rehab areas, pretty awesome. They actually look better than the original mountains that were there in the first place.
Yeah, they do a very good job. They look a little artificial.
But it's Teletubby land, so
But
when the tree starts growing on it,
same. I don't have an issue with, you know, mining for iron ore, obviously, because the business is based around it. I don't have an issue with cutting down trees either, because you can replant a tree and let them grow.
Trees grow. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
You know, there are some trees that are 500 years old and whatnot. Right.
Yeah.
Don't let those trees get cut down, because they take so long to grow.
But all it needed was good management.
Yeah.
That's all anything ever needs is good management. You know, so if you go into a bit of land and it's like, okay, you've got 10,000 new trees growing, so you need to protect those trees. And in return, you can cut down 2,000 of these other ones.
Yeah. And then you're going to replant.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the whole point. They do. They have to replant. Like, you know, there's massive efforts in those areas. They don't just strip a forest and let it be.
Yeah.
They replant. Like these days with the legislation and whatnot, which is solid legislation. Yeah. Like trees, we know they're an oxygen producer.
Yeah.
They're important to have on the
planet. No, exactly. It's just got to be managed right. Just, you know, all this deadfall that I've used off the ground here for the cabin and everything like that. Like, you've seen what I do to it. I tap it. I make sure, like, even frigging, I'm removing spiders from it.
You get spiders nonstop.
Let alone bloody if there's something else in them. And we don't clean up all the deadfall, because we understand that we need some deadfall on the ground for some of the animals to live in, because there's certain animals that will live in deadfall. So anything that's got a hollow log in it or something like that that's left, it's not like we're clearing the whole frigging ground of this dead timber. Even when we're cutting firewood that's laying around on the ground, it's not like we just go and cut the whole lot up. So everything just... Like, that's just me, myself, managing the property. But, you know, so obviously any business that's in... logging or whatever, it just needs good management.
With the legislation in Australia,
and that's why we need animal rights people, and that's why we need certain amount of greens.
There has to be a balance in everything.
Because then there becomes the balance.
There is a balance.
And we don't end up, we wiped out every kangaroo out of Australia because we had no tag system on them. You can shoot them with the bow, you can shoot them with a rifle, you can snare them, you can trap them, you can poison them.
Yeah, but what people don't know, there's literally millions and millions. I mean, you did that trip to Northern Territory. Tell them about what happened there.
That was in... So, for starters, there wasn't a metre between dead kangaroo carcasses on the side of the road
For how many k's was it?
I don't know. I reckon it was about 6 hours drive.
Not 1 meter without a
dead kangaroo. 6 hours drive. There wasn't a meter without a skeleton or a fresh carcass or a carcass that was a week old or a day old or freshly hit kangaroos that were bouncing off my bull bar, mate. Like, it was that full on. Like, thousands and thousands and thousands.
That's natural selection. That's like, there was a boom a couple of years out there, and there was. There was a lot of floodwaters.
Yeah.
The feed was just phenomenal. Kangaroos were dropping animals left and right. You know what? The part of their thing is when the season's good on dropping these animals because we need to procreate. Mm. And the more I drop, the more chance one of them's going to survive.
Yeah.
So when there's a big, big drought, you know what would happen. That's what was happening.
Yeah. What would happen on the side of the road? A kangaroo would get hit, right? It'd be on the side of the road. The grass around the kangaroo, would where it's rotting and fermenting, the blood, grass would grow, so another kangaroo would come across the road to get to it and get hit. And it's like a vicious endless cycle. And because there's a, like, not exaggerating, mate, there's a billion acres there. Well, that's probably exaggerating.
Untouched acres.
Untouched, no roads or anything through it. Unmanaged.
One road through it.
Unmanaged. So no, it's just the natural landscape. That's
it. It's not improved pasture. It's not anything. It's just a natural Australian bush out in the desert country.
Like, even there's a lot of Australians that will listen to this podcast that haven't even seen that wide expanse of Australia. It's insane up there.
No.
When I go buffalo hunting and then, you know, like Cam and Joe and that's getting keen to go for a buffalo hunt, I don't think I understand that it takes like 3.5-4 days for me just to drive there. I'm not saying you guys are going to do that. You just can fly in or pick you up at the airport. But no, it's a 3 or 4 day drive and there's hardly a town in between.
There isn't.
It's insane. And then the last town that I can get food at, supplies, before I go there, is a day's drive away minimum. And it's not even a proper town.
It's not a normal day's drive away. It's tiny.
No, definitely not a normal day's drive.
That's a death drive.
Mate, I spent $60,000 on that four-wheel drive and it only just handles the friggin' potholes in the road now. It's insane. But, yeah. I was going to answer some social media questions because we did that every time. But if I get you to read out the social media questions, Kim's going to say you're a cock blocker. So, we don't want to offend Kim.
No, but I'm not that tough.
There is a couple of questions. There's heaps of other shit that I want to talk about with you yet because I want to talk about a couple of our other epic hunts. But a couple of the questions that I've been getting a lot and I just know them off the top of my head, so I'm going to kind of say them. But everyone asked me what camera, what lens and what settings I use for night photography. But you know what, I don't think
you should give away because that's hard, isn't it? But anyway.
No, I'm happy to give away. I'm happy to share.
It's the sort of guy you are.
Do you know how, like, what sort of night? What time of night is it? Is there any artificial light? You know, is it early in the night when the sun's going down? Is the moon coming up? Is there no moon? Is there a full moon? Is there a quarter moon? Mate, and it changes for everything. And it's the same with, you know, someone will ask me, what camping gear you use? For where? Is it summer? Is it winter? Is it in the mountains? Can we drive there? Do we have to hike there? Is there water nearby? There's so many.
Yeah, so many.
And that's the beauty of photography, and that's the beauty of bow hunting. There's not just get a bow and go and hunt something.
Not one set. Mate,
there's like I'm still learning today. Yeah. And you know how hardcore and strict I've been with bow hunting, and I'm still learning stuff today. Photography, I'm still learning stuff today.
Well,
but I will tell you one setting that you can try. And it has to be on a decent camera, like a full frame or a high-end digital SLR or SLR camera. And it has to be with a lens with the lowest f-stop you can get, which means the biggest opening in the f-stop. So the one that I use, the camera is the Canon 5D Mark III on RAW setting. So it's a RAW image when you take it. And the lens is like a Sigma lens. The one that I'm running right now is a 14mm lens for landscape. And the lowest the f-stop can go is f1.8. And the setting is 15 seconds. So the camera is going to be open for 15 seconds. And the f-stop is f1.8, as low as it can go. And the ISO is 3200. It has to be on a tripod. Use it on a timer, so when you press the button, you're not shaking the camera when it takes it. So you'll hit the button, the timer would kick in, and then it'll take the photo when it's stationary. And that's probably the most regular setting.
What about if you didn't, you know, because that's high-end stuff. What about if you just had like a 40 deer or 60 deer or whatever, or 300.
Well, the 60
like, and you only got a lens that's like, you know, you got something that's like a 28 to a 70 mil. It's a pretty popular then sort of lens. Mate, can you still get a decent photo?
You can, but you'll have to push the shit out of it, and you're not going to get what I'm getting. Yeah. You know, it's a little bit like,
mind
like,
you
can't get 300 feet per second out of a bow that
no.
That doesn't
out
shoot.
Of a recurve.
Out of a recurve. Well,
no, it's like, look, what I'll say too is,
that's all I'm saying. And those, it's like, you're not going to walk the mountains and not have sore feet and a pair of Dunny fucking, what are they called?
Dunlop volleys.
You know what I mean?
KT26.
So it's one of those things where you've got to get the high-end gear to get the high-end photo.
I will say,
but I started out with a lesser camera. And when I say push it, I mean, have it open for 30 seconds, push the ISO to, I don't know, 5,000, 6,000 yeah. something, and the lowest f-stop you could get, which might be f.4. And if it's on a clear night and there's no artificial light, like, majority of my photos, good photos, don't come down to the camera as much. They come down to where I am.
Yeah.
And that's no artificial light anywhere to blur the photo or blow it out or anything like that.
But what I think, like, still not, I've got this gear, I'm going to take that photo. I don't think people understand some of the dedication that goes into it, because I know you'll get up at 2 in the morning because, you know, the stars are going to be in a certain spot, the moon's going to be in a certain spot. So yeah.
Timing, for example, location.
Like, we went to Karajini, we climbed down cliffs in the dark.
Oh, that was awesome.
Sat in the bottom of that gorge.
In Jeffrey Gorge.
It's like me with no bow today, but yeah. I didn't mind. But we were down there for like 3.5-4 hours,
yeah.
Just waiting for the Milky Way to line up with this gorge.
That was,
and then
I'll post that photo for these guys.
It's just off tap. But then we came out of that gorge, and you know, it was a hairy thing to climb in and out of. Yeah. Climbed out of that gorge, and then the moon started to rise, and then you took this photo. And you would swear it's a bright sunny day with stars in the sky.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
was just because the moon wasn't up yet. But the moon was throwing its aura because it is a curved Earth.
Yeah.
And the light of that moon was bending around.
The Earth is as flat as this table.
So the light was bending around. And then Adam, so I'm saying, like, you can have the gear, but you still got to have the dedication. And it still takes skill. Not everybody takes the best photo in the world. That's why there's better photographers.
Yeah.
There's better spear fishermen. There's better people at everything. There is certain skills there. So that photo is just like off tap. That one when we walked out of the gorge.
Yeah.
And I was like, what day did you take that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, that's right.
No, that was when we walked out the gorge.
And I'm like, no, that's at night.
Mate, and that whole landscape is lit up. Yeah. You can see green in the trees.
Well, the moon lights the landscape better than the sun do.
Yeah, it's crazy,
man. It's such a nice light to take photos in. So, but you know what was really cool about that is the fact that that Milky Way was so bright through that canyon, but once we climbed out into the top and the moon was hitting everywhere else, then it was the complete opposite where you could hardly see the Milky Way at all.
You couldn't get a shot of it.
You couldn't get a shot of the Milky Way. That's how quickly it changes. And that's why I'm saying depends on the night, the time, what sort of night. But you're just talking about the flat Earth. I don't believe the Earth's flat because it's called a globe for a reason.
I know it's not flat.
And you know, now you're going to send people that...
Who cares?
That think the world is round.
Well, you've got to get some hate messages, and, just all love. You can't have all love.
Flat Earth hate. Anyway. Hey, tell us about our trip in Montana. Because
our elk hunt.
Like, I don't reckon that was our most epic trip by a long shot.
But it was a dream trip. It was a dream trip.
I told you. Like, we'd just done a really good contract. It was a really good contract. And I wanted to give you a bit of a bonus. And because
we's hunting elk,
because I'm so selfish, the bonus was you had to come hunting with me.
That really hurt me. My heart was screaming in pain, and
awesome.
I was just in tears day and night.
I want
to take
you on.
And then I had to get
monster,
on the plane and go all the way to Montana.
Yeah, I want to take you on a monster mule deer hunt one year as well. That'd be awesome.
We'll get that done. But
it's like an excuse for you and me. It's like, no, look, I've got to do this for Antonio. He's been working real
There's
hard.
There's no benefit to you at all.
We're going to go hunting monster muleys.
Yeah. So, our elk hunt in Montana, man, it was just epic. There's one thing, I'm going to say this before we get into the hunt part, because it's one of the funniest things that's ever happened. Kim was on the mountains. No, I won't tell it. It's the best thing ever. Because a guy said that he had exactly the same feeling as Kim had on the mountain, because she said, oh, I felt a bit of vertigo and whatnot.
Kim was getting the monthlies.
She got her monthlies. And then this guy's going...
Tiny Flo was coming to visit.
So she's telling the story about it. And there was a guy and he's
Rick.
Going...
It was Rick. We talked about
it. No, it wasn't Rick.
Rick.
It wasn't Rick. It was the other dude that was cameraman for me.
Oh, yeah. Was too.
Because what happened was we had a pretty flat day. So we said, oh, let's grab Kim and my guide and him. And we went down for lunch in town. And it was pretty cool. Went to this diner. And so she's telling me, like, a little bit came out very, but then she told me, she goes, oh, I was so terrible. I felt so sick. And she told me what had happened, you know. And it's natural, who cares? And then, but he caught a bit of it and he says, when I was up, because we were climbing high, you know, we were going from 6,000 to 10 and 12,000 feet. And I remember the first time I did get up there, I could feel my heart the very first time when I got to that elevation. I was like, whoa. Just took about a 30-meter little climb, and I was like, "Fuck, this is—I can feel this," you know. But then, after that, you just get acclimatized to it and just walk the mountains the whole week.
First, you think you're really unfit. Like I don't even think of the height, and I'm
which
like,
"I am.
Am I not as fit as I thought?"
But anyway, so how it came about? I guess yeah, and he goes, "Well, when I was on the mountain, I got that feeling as well," and I'm like. I don't think you got that feeling. Because, I got exactly what Kim got. And I'm going, dude, honestly, I don't think you got what Kim got. And he's going, no, I did, man, I did. I felt I had vertigo and all this. And I'm hitting Kim in the leg under the table, just wanting to kill myself laughing, you know.
Kim's like, you did know what I had, buddy.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. But anyway, yeah. So in Montana, so...
Unless you're bleeding from the
heart
of your penis.
It was a tough hunt. It was like over 30 degrees Celsius most days.
Yeah.
Elk were staying way up high. They weren't moving around. They weren't making noise. It was tough going. Adam, so on the second last day, the very last
you
day.
You keep telling the story.
The day before the second last day, so it was Kim's birthday. And actually, that was the day we went down for lunch. And Kim wasn't feeling that great, so she didn't want to go out on the mountain. Adam went up and I went out in the afternoon. And then Adam said, I'm going to go up here. I'm going to meet you at a certain junction. Me and my guide, young Zach, he was a top kid. I really, really liked that guy. We went up into another catchment and climbed right up into the back of it. And we had a few bugles and whatnot. Adam got a text me because when you're up in those mountains, you're sort of, you know, 30, 40 miles away from the nearest towns, but you sort of pick up your mobile reception, which wasn't good for me because I'd be getting work texts and whatnot. But Adam texts me, I just shot a giant. And I said, send me a pic. He goes, well, I can't get a pic here, but I can tell you I shot a giant. He goes, I'm going to meet you at 7 o'clock at the junction.
No, it was 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, all right. He said 8 o'clock at the junction. I still got a text I can check.
Don't make it worse.
So, all right, it's worse. So it's Kim's birthday. We've gone into town in the morning. We've bought her an ice cream cake for the night. It was going to be a big celebration in camp. We had...
Whose plan was it to buy the ice cream cake?
The Bucks of Tekamati for... It was Adam's plan. The Bucks of Tekamati were there filming. So that was Jordan Shipley, his cousin.
Is it Tekamati?
Tekamati.
I thought it was Tacoma.
Yeah, it's Tekamati. And so everybody was in on this celebration for Kim. Adam shot this elk. And mate, he shot it in
For starters, because it was Kim's birthday... I was only going to hunt for half the day. But you know what it's like. You got to keep at it.
Yeah.
I was just going to hunt for half the day. Kim knows me well enough that half a day actually means like a day. But
and a half.
half a day. And I just kept going along the ridge. And I'd get onto a bull and it just wasn't quite big enough. And then a bugle would be a bit further. Okay. And then a bugle would be a bit further. And a bugle. Mate. And I went so far up that ridge.
You did.
It was insane.
So he's shot this elk. So then... Zach and I have come down the mountain. That was like my first sort of chance. One was bugling. We called it down, sort of hung up at 90 metres. And, you know, I'm like, it was like a 6x6. It would have been about probably a 300 sort of score. Really nice elk. I would have shot it after the week we were having. And so then it's like, all right, we better get back. We've got to meet Adam at Shit Creek, at the bottom of Shit Creek. That's what it was called. And
it's called Shit Creek for a reason.
So, mate, shit it was crack. Nasty. It's nasty country. Shit crack. Yeah, we've got to say it right, like the Montanans. And so we're driving. We had a six-wheeler that day. So we sort of had the six-wheeler, just drive to the bottom of the valley and then just climb up in these mountains and climb back down. So we're like, Adam's going to meet us here at this time. So we're driving the road and up. Maybe he's come out here. Maybe he's come out there. Mate, we were looking for Adam. We nearly ran out of fuel. We had to shoot all the way back. This is about probably 40 Ks to get fuel.
Was it dark at this point?
Yeah. No, it's pitch black.
Yeah, because I remember, like, I was still coming off the top of the mountain. Yeah. So I had to hang all the meat, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I fully field dressed it, I hung the meat. And because all those trees, like, it's all burn, there's no branches to hang meat on. So I had to stack fallen trees up like this.
You get meat off.
I had to tie the meat onto another big tree that I strung across. And then I had to put, because I was worried about bears freaking robbing me of the meat, because, you know, there's a heap of grizzlies up there. So then I had to pull down on that tree and I tied it. I had a little bit of string on me and I tied it to the base of another tree so the meat was hanging up in the air like that.
So
that's all I could do.
So we're driving around the base of this mountain line and we're going back and forth and we're like, man, this is getting scary, you know, like it's getting...
What I was getting at is I just seen your lights off in the distance going the wrong way and I'm like, this isn't good. Yeah, and because, you know, we lost the cameraman the night before,
yeah,
my headlight, I burnt all my headlight up, all the batteries, looking for the cameraman. Yeah,
but you didn't think about replacing them. So,
no.
So then...
Not at 4 in the morning.
I don't know this, but Adam's coming off the mountain and all he's got, because his headlamp's gone flat, he's stripped everything, he left his bow behind, but he wasn't letting the cape and the antlers go. And, you know, there's a lot of weight just in that. He's got his camera flash... And he's just doing a flash and seeing what's in front of him and walking. And, like, I'll get to the rest of it at the end. But basically, it got to about probably... It was after midnight and I just saw the flash. One flash. Mm. And it was still probably 500 metres in elevation up.
Mate, it was the worst mountainside that I could have been on.
Yeah. So the next... So we'll talk about that when we get to the next day. Because so what happened then was... So we parked up. I'm like... We parked up and then... Zach and I started climbing up to where we saw the flash, because obviously that's where Adam was. I'm thinking, what the hell's
going
on?
You know why it was so dark? Because remember how overcast it come over?
Yeah,
it was full dark. Like, it was pitch black. Yeah. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face, dude.
It was pretty bad. So then I've climbed up to where Adam was, and I find him. He's just lying next to a creek. He's just had his face in the water having a drink, and he was shot. He was shot to pieces. Laying in the antlers, like they were cradling him, and these antlers are out, you know, they're like 50 inches wide, they were 54 inches long, big antlers. He's just laying in there. I got this photo on my phone, it's an awesome photo. You just
I don't even have that photo.
Total exhaustion on his face. Mm. He's just laying there, and he's basically said to me, he goes, I was just going to sleep here the whole night, I've given up. And that's one thing that, how many times have you said given up in your life?
Yeah, twice.
Twice.
No, it's like, I think that's the second time. No, well, one of the times was when we had Laura Zara in here. Laura's from Naked and Afraid. She's a mad survivalist. And I'm like, I had all the kids here in camp. Remember, we'll just camp down the bottom on the creek. We didn't have a cabin here. And I'm like, oh, I'll start a fire. The kids will love it. So I've been going at this thing for a bit.
No, first Laura said, I'll start a fire.
No, I'd already started. And then she's like, oh, good idea. And then, so she comes along about 20 minutes after I'd even started.
Yeah.
And in about 2 minutes, she had this raging fire. It nearly burnt the whole fucking building.
So you got to remember that Australian hardwood is not very conducive to rubbing together to make fire.
Mate,
and that's what we've got
My back was screwed. I had 3 hours where I was just like...
It was more...
Was it more?
So what happened was...
Can we say 3 hours?
No, because I've got to tell what happened. Because what happened then was Andrew and Laura, Wilsey, kids, they all went down for a swim in the creek. And then Adam's like, I'm not giving up. I'm getting this fire done. So while he's doing that, I'm packing up camp, which was a couple of tents, crap everywhere. I've managed to pack every single bit of kit we've got, and you were still going. Well, remember one time you had the perfect ember, and you went to put it on your kindling, and it fell on the green grass next to it, and you nearly cried.
Yeah.
You had blisters.
There was two or three times, like, I'd get it full smoke, and it start to go red, and the string would go snap.
Yep.
I'd start doing it again, and then the stick would go snap.
Yeah.
The little bit, I ground the hole right through it, and it's getting... Oh, and I'm like, yeah, I've got embers. It's just going to drop on the little kindling like that, and then it just would snap.
It. You would have got it if it hit the kindling. But anyway, that day you lost it.
Yeah.
You threw shit.
Did
you
I?
Swore shit. You said... Yeah.
That's why no one needs to be my critic, mate. I'm my biggest critic.
Yeah.
Like, and I've always said
it
that.
No
one needs to put me down, because if I fuck up... No one will put me down as well as I can put myself down.
So anyway, back to this elk hunt. So Adam's laying there. He didn't care what was going to happen to him that night. He was that exhausted. He was going to just lay there. If bears came, wolves came, whatever. I wasn't going to leave him out in the mountain, because I'm conscious of that, so I'm like...
Well, I had friggin'
elk... can't leave him out.
I had elk blood dripped all over me. I had friggin' meat all up my hands. Like, you know what it takes to butcher an elk in the bush and hang all the meat?
Yeah.
I was stinking of fresh, juicy elk.
Yeah.
And it's full grizzly bill. Like, that one growled at me and Kim, like, yeah, only 3 days before that.
I was walking around crap. I seen a couple of black bears. The grizzlies were there. So, anyway, we got that elk off the mountain. We got him back, so... By the time we got back, it was about 1:30 in the morning. Kim's cake is melted. They've had a celebration. We didn't make it.
Oh, so. I didn't know they had the celebration.
No, we thought you were going to
have it. And I just found the cake dumped out in the yard.
Melted.
And I'm like, oh, my God. So I resuscitated the cake and took it back inside. I set it up real nice and I walked into the cabin. I'm like, hey, babe. Hey. What are you doing, beautiful? like I know. I know I'm a cunt. No one needs to tell me. I know.
But look,
and then, it was hard. Because I've missed every one of Kim's birthdays because September. Duh. Like, you know, elk's happening. This was the one where I wasn't going to miss it because I was... And, you know, I'd already missed it. It was the next morning.
So, yes.
But then I woke her up. And then, and she was dirty. Like, don't get me wrong. I would have been dirty too. I would have been so dirty. But anyway, we woke her up, which probably made it worse. Well, I woke her up.
We forced her to come out.
We forced her to come out into the freezing cold. Sang where she had an ice cream cake that was even colder. Sang happy birthday to her. She sort of smirked and smiled because she's sort of that girl that just gets happy. But, and then she's like, I've already had the cake.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I was like, oh.
And then she went. So then the next day came. So Adam then had to go up and get the meat the next morning. And when we looked at where he came down that night,
it was
cliffs, man.
It was full night.
It was crazy. This is
one thing that I remember. Like, I remember stacking it heaps and sliding down big rock draws and wedged. Everything like that. I got wedged in between two rocks. I remember using the antlers as brakes. I'd dig it when I'd start sliding down one of them big rock draws. I'd dig the antlers in. Like, I know it's not great, but anyway, probably saved me a lot.
Better than dying.
But then, and I wouldn't even know what was in front
you're
of me.
You're only lighting it. Every now and then with the camera flashing, I can see 5 meters, I'm going to walk for
mate, so a stick, like you remember seeing how many holes I had in my legs and bruises and cuts. Like I'd be sliding down and then a deadfall stick would be going that way and it'd drive it up into my pant leg, you know. I was lucky I'd never took any real deep under the flesh. They were just all surface wounds. But I got into that point and I'd been going down for so long and I'm like, it must be close. And I hit the camera flash. And there was a rock wall right in front of me, this far away from my face, dude.
Yeah.
A rock wall. And I flashed that way and I flashed that way. And I had to walk back up out of the drawer. After going all the way down there, I had to walk back up out of the drawer to get around that rock face to come back down. It was like a knife rock face just come up out of the ground like that through the drawer.
It was pretty savage. So that happened. Obviously, Adam got the meat. And then the rest of the trip, it was like, I have to please Kim time, and you went fishing and did lots of nice things. And it was never something that was intended, but sometimes when you're stuck out in the mountain in the middle of the night and you got an elk on your shoulders.
It was happy days. Look, Kim knew what it was because I've told her, but Kim up until that point just thought, I walk out into the bush and shit dies. Like, she's seen though, there's no givens. In free range hunting, there's no given, dude.
Yeah.
You've got to bust your ass, especially that. Like, a lot of people don't understand what's going on here, but I'm walking in the public land where anyone can hunt. It's friggin' tough hunting.
Yeah.
So when it's a hunt like that, you've got to put in every little bit of effort. And like I said, Kim knows what it was. And
you could always come back unsuccessful and still magic out there.
No, that's exactly right. But you know.
So then the next morning, Jordan shot his elk, which was a really nice elk. So happy times in camp. All this meat was getting cut up. Old Antoine here still hasn't shot his elk.
Me and Kim went trout fishing.
You went trout fishing. The next morning was the last day. The morning, like, we sort of flogged the spot we'd flogged, and I'm like, but then we heard some bugles, and we thought,
no, remember, we bedded some elk. I told you that big, there was a real big double six.
You took a photo 4 days before. You said, this is the elk that I want, and it was right over the back of the mountain. Yeah,
it was a real big double six, and he had 200 hinds minimum.
Easy. So
and
that,
I told you that he's moving back down the range.
So that afternoon... So that morning, we bedded a bunch of elk and we're like, let's leave them there and let's come back this other when they stand up. And then, you know, I remember Adam saying to me, like, don't, if they call them, you can't get to them. Don't worry, just do what we do in Australia. Just stalk them. You can do it. And it was like that. that rang in my head the whole time. I'm like, yeah, man, we make, you know, we make, you do, you make shit.
We make shit happen.
We make shit happen, yeah. Man. You know, you push your luck and shit happens. So I ended up getting onto that mob of 200 elk.
Yeah.
And I didn't even see this bull. He had a bugle. It wasn't even a bugle. It was a roar. It
you know, like, one of the reasons why, because this is a nice little bit of insight into for elk hunters. You know, the reason why I said if you call and he ain't coming, just get in there and stalk him.
Stalk him.
Because he had 200 hinds and he already had 7 satellite bulls hanging off him.
Yeah, that was crazy. Like,
why is your call going to be any special? Because they're all calling.
Yeah, so I ain't going to harp on about the hunt, but it was the most epic thing I've ever been involved in.
Oh, it was freaking awesome.
The way it happened, the amount of elk I was around, it was crazy. Rick on the camera caught it on the camera. It was just off tap. So I shot this bull.
And hey, did Jordan ever use that footage?
I don't know.
Because he released that episode.
You had some words that we put together, but we never gave it to him. Remember the next day. So basically, I shot this bull, and then it started to get dark. And then we said, you know what, let's just let him be. Let's go back. And it was celebration time. Free bow hunters in camp. Everyone had shot a big bull. Like, I didn't see the antlers on that bull until it was silhouetted at the very last part of stalking.
Oh,
I'm like,
the best
all bull. There was one time at start, I saw
I'm nearly,
a bit of
I'm
the
nearly,
top two tines.
I'm nearly quivering. You talking about that bull.
I saw the top two tines go past me. Like, I was like 20 metres, man. I just saw the tines go. I could hear him roaring. He was so specific, his roar. But like I said, I went up on a bit. But I did see his two tines. I thought, he's big. And then it was fine at the very end of the stalk. He was just there silhouetted, man. I got up. And I crawled in and stood up and shot him at 35 metres. So we had it, and then we went back to the cabin. Everyone was over the moon. Everybody had shot an elk in camp. This is the coolest, talking about it. And then, so by that time, but things had happened with Adam and Kim with the birthday. So Adam wasn't going to be up all night celebrating. Adam and Kim went to bed probably about 10:30, 11 o'clock.
Well, I definitely wanted to. But you had there was a bunch of guys that went out there to help you.
Yeah, so because what happened? So this is what happened. So then we came back, we had dinner and all that, and they said, let's go out for a bit of a look. So 6 of us went out, and it was such good fun. We're finding blood, but you know, it's in the dark and you're pushing things around, you're hearing things go around, you're kind of like, it's not very good. Adam had gone to bed. We came back, mate, got back at probably. And then we stayed up, still talking and laughing, 3 o'clock in the morning. Everyone was like, nah, we'll all have a good sleep in. Mate, the whole week, we were waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, the whole week. The earliest I got to bed any night was midnight. Most of the nights were 12:30, 1, 1:30. You know, it was just massive, massive, who cares? I'm here to hunt for 6-7 days. I don't even care if I drop dead from no sleep because I'm going to keep pushing. You're not going to die from no sleep.
Mm.
So Adam we got
awesome
the bed at
statement.
About.
You're not going to die because of no sleep.
You're not. Eventually, you will fall asleep when you have to.
Yeah.
But so.
Don't you die after 3 days without sleep?
Oh, we didn't that week. Adrenaline keeps you going. So Adam comes in my room 4 o'clock in the morning. Hey, get up. Get up. I'm going, dude, I've been in bed for 1 hour, man. Everyone's sleeping in today. We're going, no, we've got to go find your elk.
Well, we had to fly out.
Right?
No,
we had
bullshit.
The,
we had
the, no, no.
We had
the other hunters were coming in camp at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we had accommodation in town for that night.
Yeah.
You were flying out the next day. I flew to San Francisco and watched the NFL.
That's right, yeah.
So Adam's like, come on, man. Let's go, me and you. And I'm going, Adam, fuck. He goes, no, you're not doing it. You can sleep later. Don't worry about it. And I'm like, fuck, all right. Get up, get dressed. And I'm going, we're taking the 6-wheeler. So we've taken the 6-wheeler. I GPSed the night before the last bit of blood we found. Adam and I got up to where the blood was and we walked around, so be it. And it was like the blood sort of stopped at one point. But it was crazy amounts of blood. And just like, how much blood can this thing have in its body?
And it was good blood. It was hard.
It was crazy
blood,
blood, man. It was like times it was doing circles and you could just see swells.
Yeah, if there's any non-hunters.
And Adam just said,
if there's not any non-hunters listening, you can tell what blood's from what organ of the animal.
Yeah.
And it was heart blood.
Yeah. So Adam goes, look, I'm just going to go up on this next little bench. So there's all old logging trails on this property. And so I'm just trying to stick to where I think I always think of the least, what's the word for it? It's the direction of least resistance. That's where I think a deer will go when it's hurt. It'll choose the path of least resistance. So I was just sticking, all right, well, I'm not seeing any blood right now. It's gone this way. Adam goes, look, I'm just going to go up 30 metres above you. I'm just going to take that track. Mate, he got up there, and they, 2 seconds later, oh, found blood. And I'm like, yes. We didn't go too much further, bang, this elk's on the ground.
Oh, so. Well, the blood just went blop, blop,
yeah,
blop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Done.
So it was a big elk. So I think what's happened was he might have been bedded there the night before where we found all that blood, and we spooked it. And in the moment that it sort of probably jumped up to that next bench, we were still thinking it's got to be around where this blood is. And Adam's just happened to found it up here, and then, mate, it was just heaps of blood died.
Mm.
So then we took...
Well, we were now, happy. People are going to hear this and go, oh, heart shot. No, it should have dropped. From experience,
it was hard.
Multiple times... Just because you shot something in the heart doesn't mean you're going to kill it within seconds.
Well, there's
seconds.
Four ventricles in the heart that yeah. move the blood around.
Yeah.
If you... yes, blood's going to come out of you, slice one, but if there's still pressure in that heart, it can still push heart blood into its lungs, something. Have blood go into its brain
yeah.
and go.
That's why double lungs is always the shot yeah. for bow hunters. And if by chance you end up going a little bit lower, top of the heart's awesome, but there's cut still the no guarantee... T that if you're going in the lower part of the heart, if you slice just one of the sides of the chambers...
Or a muscle. You yeah. might only just hit the muscle.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this elk, it was dead. And we would have found it the night before, but I think we jumped it. Basically.
Well, technically, it only went about 70 or 80 metres.
No, it went a bit... Well, from where we last found it. Yeah. It had gone a bit further than that originally. But anyway, it was big old animal. We were happy as, took our photos, and then we're like... Man, we're going to bring this thing because it was still...
Oh, it was a monster.
We're going to bring this thing because the six-wheelers have got a winch. So yeah. we're like, we're going to winch this thing on the back of the six-wheeler. We're going to roll into camp with this big bomb elk. So we started trying to find a way to get to it because there's all these old logging trails and it was on a logging trail where it died. So we're like, man, these logging trails, they all link up. We'll get there. And as we'll taking different routes, we went all the way back around. We ended up on this one spot. It was a bit of a bog, and in the bog, there was a log with a spike on it, basically, and punched the right-hand tire. And we're like, it's not good. Got a flat tire, but six wheels,
still
lots
got
of traction. We've still got to drive back anyway, and we're still heading, we're around where
we're
elk
right
was.
Near it, yeah.
Yeah, we're right near it. Had it on GPS. We're like, man, it's one of these trails has just got to get there. And then we came around, there was one section that was a bit of a bog, and I said, maybe just hop out on this bit so I'll get no weight on that side where the flat tyre was. Adam's made up around his corner, and then there was like a washout on the logging trail. And it was still wide enough for the thing, and Adam's going, and I'm going, and I sort of said, it's a bit narrow, and he goes, no, look, I think there's enough room. And I'm sitting on the side with the flat tyre where the washout is. So I'm keeping an eye out on this side, and Adam's keeping an eye on that side, but...
No,
what happened
I was
on
the washout side.
No, I was. Because I went, I stepped out and stepped back in. You were holding the wheels on the left-hand side and I was on the right? So this is what happened. So what happened was as we went, there was a tree, a ball root of a tree on the other side. And when that right-hand tyre touched it, that combined with the flat tyre on this side, had the machine go up like that. And it sort of edged onto the washout part of it. And I actually put my feet out. This is going to tip. And then as I went to put my feet, I'm like, no, it's going to tip on me. I jumped back in and grabbed on.
Yeah.
And then we went.
Yeah.
And we went over. And then it's just straight. It was steep.
You know
it
why? Because that first drop was such a drop.
No, it was just
mate,
steep.
It rolled hard. And I'll tell you how hard it rolled. It rolled so hard that when I hit the steering wheel, it broke. The round bar in the steering wheel.
So Adam's got a hold of the steering wheel. And I can remember when we went over the second time, looking at Adam with his back on the roof of this six-wheeler holding onto the steering wheel.
Mm.
And I remember Adam saying
to
me...
Well, I just knew you didn't want to come out.
And I was, like, as we rolled around, just putting my feet and my hands in place, just trying to grab things. So on the second roll, as it came off the ground and it came up, it flicked me out. Like, I went flying.
Tossed you
and out. Then... What it did was it smashed my fingers.
This is hilarious. Well, it's not hilarious. It's very serious. But
I didn't
the
even
fact
look
that it. You started this podcast talking about you had two broken thumbs.
And now
continue.
It is a story of my life. So as I came out and I hit the ground, I've hit my head pretty hard. I still was conscious and I looked and I watched it roll a couple more times. And then at the end, it stayed on its side and the wheels were facing me.
Yeah.
And... On that last roll was when the steering wheel broke for Adam. Then he finally fell out. And on that last roll, it bloody rolled on him. Yeah. Adam's, where are you? Where are you?
So I woke up with the roll bar of the six-wheeler across
your body.
Across my groin.
You had to get yourself out.
So I sort of dragged myself out, just adrenaline, like I reckon it took 2 seconds. I dragged myself out from under there, and that's where I just ran around frantically looking for, because I didn't know if it rolled over the top of you, it thrown you on your neck or what.
So
my first concern was,
I heard you going, where are you, where are you? And you were looking up where all the stuff fell out the back of it at the top, and I was like, not far from you. I said, he goes, are you all right, are you all right? I said, oh, I'm all right, but my fingers. And when I put my hands up, these two fingers, one was going that way, one was going that way. Yeah. These ones were busted, but the webbing split on this.
Well,
so
they,
I think
they
that
turned them right back too, didn't they? I think the doctor said they turned them right back.
Yeah, so what happened here was the webbing split in here, and I think that took the brunt of the impact, so I didn't bust this hand up so bad, but this one was bad. So I ended up just going like this, and then, and that's about as straight as my fingers got out of that exercise. Yeah. So there's still, I can't close a fist, can't do anything like that. And I'm going, Adam, are you all right? And he's going, oh, my back. Oh, I think I've ruptured a kidney. And then I said, give me a look. And you lifted your shirt up, and there was a bruise like this.
Oh, my God.
And it was yellow, it was pink, it was black, it was blue. Yeah. It was every colour a bruise phase can be in that instant. And I thought, that ain't good. And you were like, oh, fuck.
And well, remember I walked up the mountain to get reception.
Then you said, your phone got smashed. Yeah. We picked my phone up, and it was bent like a banana, but it still turned on. You said, I'm going to try and get up the hill and get reception. I'm like, well, I'll start cleaning things up. So Adam's gone up, he's yelling out for help, trying to get reception, can't get reception. He's come down the mountain, and, you know, it was quite a profound thing that you said to me. You said, look, this is the time we've got to be men. We've got ourselves into this.
First, I was thinking about when I turned down the mountain, and then this side of me just...
Oh, every time you were walking down, you were like yelling out in pain,
mate,
like really loud.
Mate, it was so painful.
Every second or third step, you get a little jolt, and you'd be, and I was like, fuck, this is pretty bad.
I'll jump to the chase of that bit, because I'd actually snapped me...
Well, the hip was broken.
I'd snapped
across
me
the
hip,
front
I'd
here.
Broken my hip.
Probably that wide and about that long, broke off the front of his hip. Yeah. But we didn't know that. At the time, we thought it was kidney or his back, because that's where all the bruising was. But the impact was here, squashed his back. The pain was just going right through his body. But in the end, it was. Got x-rays, it was broken hip. Me, I had broken fingers.
All part of a hunt.
I had broken fingers, snapped tendons. So my hands took 6-7 months to recover. And this one, like I said, this one's still not good. But anyway, I always say at that point, the hunt becomes an adventure. It is.
Or a hospital
that's
trip.
Part of the... Who gives a shit? Yeah. No hospital trip.
It's
not an adventure.
Good. I'm not complaining. It was friggin' awesome.
So we came... So then in the roll, we lost 2 more tyres. So there was 2 on one side, 1 on the other. The thing was on its side. We ended up having to get the winch undone.
What did I say to you when I come down the hill?
You said, all right, can't get anyone to help us. We're men. We got ourselves into this. No one is going to help us get out of it. We're going to have to get ourselves out of it. That's what you said. And I'm like, all right, that was it. Just switched on, stuff it. We're in pain. Who gives a shit? It's time to survive. We got that thing started. We said,
remember we run the winch.
No,
back
we undid
under
it. Yeah.
Over it.
We had to do a few things to get it happening anyway. Then
in the end, we both had the... You couldn't push with your fingers.
No,
your
I could push with my palms,
up.
But you couldn't push
with
your
palms. So you pushed with your palms. I couldn't do the thing because of my hips. Yeah. I only had to push off one bit of a leg.
And it was pretty hardcore. And then the decision was, look, we've marked the elk. If we get back in time, because by then it's getting hot. The elk's been now dead for many hours. And we said, let's get back to camp and tell them what's happened. They're going to be stressing. It was already 11:30 at that time. So we decided to drive back and we got lost.
Well, the problem was...
We headed right out to near where you were lost that night.
Well, and the other thing was that to drive all the way back there, get the other crew to recover the elk, you would have lost all the meat altogether. Yeah. You would have lost all the cape, the whole lot. And that's when I said, you know what?
So we got lost and then we found our way back to where we rolled. And then you said, you know what? By the time they get back here, everything's going to be destroyed. We physically couldn't carry anything. I couldn't do much with my hands. So we decided, right, we'll get the antlers. We'll still mark it on a GPS. We had our bow was there. The camera was there and stuff like that. So Adam sat down next to the elk and, well, we did actually try to cut the meat out and it started to smell anyway. Do you remember? We actually, the first thing we did was like, let's open up for the back straps at least. And it stank. Like it was already going rank. It was right in the bright sunshine where it died.
Yeah. I want everyone that's listening to this podcast to know how much it hurt by not being able to take that meat.
Yeah. Especially when we recovered every other bit of everything else. Yeah,
because
you know?
There's certain people that probably find an excuse to leave some meat behind. That's not us, especially in that situation.
So, and we had no hope in hell of getting the machine near it. We had no hope in hell of carrying anything. Like, we were injured, you know. So Adam actually sat himself down and he cut the antlers off.
Well, I could use my hands. Like I said, I could use my hands.
I could use my back.
You could use your back. So you could carry, but I could do the technical shit.
So then I put the pack on my back, and then Adam sort of got the straps and tied it to the elk on the antlers. And then I sort of shimmied around and got myself up, and we got back to the thing.
Do you know how much, I don't even think I elaborated at the time, how much it hurt walking from the elk back to the six-wheeler at that point?
It was probably...
Mate, every step I felt like I was going to piss myself. That's why I thought I cut me bladder.
Yeah, cut
like
your bladder.
I thought I snapped the bone and then cut the bladder and damaged the kidney.
Yeah.
But I'm like, no, we need to get this elk out. We're supposed to be out of here.
So then we're driving... So we end up... We get back in the thing. We're driving back. And then just to rub salt into the wound...
Oh, shit.
He ran over a stick and would have been about... You know, a meter and a half.
You can't
long.
Help it.
And about every round,
you say it like I fucking lined the stick.
You lined it up. You said that's
the sticks
it. And
everywhere.
Not
you can't
as
help
much
it.
As me, so something else has got to happen. Anyway, with the flat tire, it flicked the stick up, mate. It cracked me in the jaw, cut me open, busted me jaw. I'm just like seeing stars. He's like, I don't know how you're not knocked out right now. Hit me that arm.
I cracked, dude. I heard it. Thump.
Smacked me. Anyway, we got back into camp, and it was the worst feeling. Everyone came out running because they could see these antlers on the back of the thing, and they were so excited. And it was so depressing that we had to tell them what happened. Like, it was a sad moment. It was such a brilliant week, beautiful people to be around. And it was, even though it was, you know, capping the hunt that everybody shot an elk, and it was a really nice elk that I shot.
It was just the biggest downer. Well, they were worried about our injuries and maybe we're the sort of person to turn around and friggin' try and sue them or do
something like that, which
we're totally not. Like
I was a
that's not
I was
even
like
part of the process.
I felt so bad about what had happened. Like, it was just, it was something that we never set out to do, and it was an accident, literally an accident. You know, that even the thoughts of my hands, they were just out of my mind. I didn't even care. Like, I'm just like, who cares? They're broken fingers. They'll mend themselves.
Exactly.
I felt like,
but that's,
you know,
just
they had a guiding season. The machine was damaged, and I'm like, this is the worst. Yeah. You know. It was, those sites are part of it. I mean, you know, say what you will about it, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was a terrible feeling. There was not one bit of joy. Even those antlers, like, it was not one even, you couldn't even say, oh, well done on the elk. You know, it was nothing like that. You just couldn't even, I didn't even care.
Yeah.
It was like that. So, anyway.
You didn't care, but now if you look back, we did the right thing by trying to recover the meat and by taking the antlers and by doing everything we could. Otherwise, it was a whole other drama again, driving back in there and trying to recover it again.
No, well, then they would have had to... Well, what was happening was we had to leave because the other people were in camp. By then, it was like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, it would have made it worse.
And you know, they were stressed because Adam and I were not back. It was stressful for them. You know, they don't know what's happened to us.
Oh, well,
you know,
Kim
there
was
peeping
as well.
Everyone was really worried for us. Yeah. I mean, we were worried for ourselves, obviously. But look, that was probably one of the most, it was an epic week. That stuff did happen. There's all the sad sides of it, but man, it was just like, it was huge. What the whole scenario of that whole week was just huge.
Yeah, no, we got it done.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, we should wrap this up. Thanks for coming on. You've been a friggin' mad guest. You're not as good to look at as Kim, but you go all right, I suppose.
I didn't shave, otherwise I'd be on par.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it was an epic hunt today. I think we've both got to head home and get some shit done. But I wanted to actually thank, you know, because a few people sent me messages about, you know, about who inspires me, you know. Well, as far as the podcast go, like, Joe Rogan's been a massive inspiration for the podcast. So I just wanted to thank Joe and Cameron Haynes, Rich Outdoors podcast. Knock On's like one of my favorite ones as well, especially if we're talking about the technical stuff with John knows his shit. But yeah, just I think just anyone that sends me a message and anyone that tunes in, anyone that goes on my Instagram and gives me a like and follows along and sends positive vibe inspires me.
Well, I think you're giving people something too, you know.
Oh,
people,
for sure.
People don't get to go out and enjoy the outdoors as much And, you know, you're giving them something that that's cool. I get to look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
yeah.
while they're not being able to do it themselves,
yeah.
it still helps them pass the day and think, that's cool, that's awesome, that's cool, that's awesome. And it's something that they love doing themselves and they're loving seeing someone else yeah. do it. And that's what it's all about.
Well, that's what, you know, these legends that we're talking about beforehand, like Dave Whiting and all these guys that used to write for the magazine, mate, that's what they done. They wrote those articles. They wrote those articles and...
Inspired.
It's like, well, I'm not getting out there to go, you know, fox hunting at the moment, but you'd read Dave's article and it'd inspire you to want to go out there and yeah. do it. But at least while you're not doing it, just live it through him, you know?
Yeah.
And,
you know, there was a wave. There was your Dave Whiting era, then you sort of had the forum era, and then, you know, then Brad Smith with his videos, and
yeah.
even Brett Verko with his videos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Daryl Bulger.
Yeah.
All these guys brought out some videos. Wayne Priest brought out some cool videos.
Yeah.
You know, and now you've got a new wave of guys. You know, your Nick Mortons and Casey McCallum, you know, yourself, Ben Solaris.
Freaking Jerry Redmond, mate.
Jerry Redmond, you awesome. Know, like, and I'm sorry if I'm forgetting people. Aiden. You know, you've got bloody Doug and Tony, obviously. Just a whole heap of new generation of people who've sort of taken that candle and run with it and driving the industry forward. And it's all positive, good people, and that's what we need to have.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Thanks for tuning in. And podcast number 2 is in the bag, or in the iPhone 7, I should say.
Thanks for having me on, man.
That's right. Probably never happen again. So I hope you made the most of it.